it's Jeff Blair, host of the new podcast, Writer's Block. If you're hearing this via your primetime sports feed, follow the link in the show description to subscribe to Writer's Block for more great sports talk and interviews from myself, Richard Deitch, and Stephen Brunt. Writer's Block, sharp takes, not hot takes. Thanks. 439, oh, 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 Pizza Nova.
439, oh, 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 Pizza Nova. Ciao, I'm Dominic Rimucci. Halloween is a great time of year to throw a party for your friends and family. And what would be better than a delicious, mouth-watering pizza made with your favorite toppings and oven-baked to perfection? From my family to yours, have a safe and happy Halloween. 439, oh, oh, oh.
Once a sports reporter, always a sports reporter. Sometimes a cynical and sarcastic sports reporter, but yeah, always a sports reporter. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Up on it. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Yeah, Mr. Deitch. Good to see you. Good to see you. We want to start with a weird weekend. Well, not weird, busy. The Leafs split the weekend. The obligatory loss in the back-to-back games against Montreal, right. Which will do nothing. Basically undid all the good of the 4-1 win over the Sharks. The Raptors split the weekend. God, I hope this season turns out to be more interesting for the Raptors than I think it's going to be. And I guess the big story: the Astros have won three straight games. They take a 3-2 lead in the World Series over the Washington Nationals. Pretty conclusive road sweep, I would say. 4-1, 7-1, and 8-1, I believe.
Yeah,
that's not bad.
So let's start there. Do you? And again, you have covered baseball far longer and more thorough than I have. But do you read into anything of the notion that the home field in this series and home field in some recent World Series games has kind of been rendered moot? And my only thought on this, and listen, it's not necessarily a fully formed thought, is, but has data gotten to the point so great where like the decline of the in-stadium advantage maybe decreases a little bit in baseball compared to other sports where, you know this, Jeff, like, how many times do we hear, like, the NBA's home court or college football's home court? Right. But baseball seems to be at least slightly negated a little.
I mean, the only real advantage I think a home team has in baseball is the fact that they bat last.
Right.
You know, we've got interleague play now, so it's not as if players are stepping in onto a field that's completely foreign to them. For the most part, they've been there.
Great point.
There is so much data, and you know, I just think that sometimes people tend to complicate baseball, to overcomplicate it. Basically, the approach that works for you in Houston should work for you in any ballpark. The difference is, the balls that land in the gap in other ballparks are probably going to be out in Houston or vice. I mean, there's some parks. Look, I think Fenway Park, you know, it wasn't a home field advantage for the Red Sox this year. Yankee Stadium, I think, and I know a guy like Kevin Barker could speak more to this, but when you have a stadium like Yankee Stadium with such a, you know, with such a pronounced area you want to aim for, right, in right field, just the small fence, the shortness in that corner and all that. Well, then if you're a hitter and you're in an emergency situation, or you're in a situation where the count isn't necessarily in your favor, you can rescue it by simply trying to, if you're a left-handed hitter, pull the hell out of the ball down there.
Right.
But I don't think it really changes all that much, especially now that it's a, you know, the it's strikeout, walk, and home run. Well, right? And the home runs go, home runs fly. It's not, the thing about this World Series that interests me, we've had a number of home runs that have almost been caught. Almost been caught. And in general this year, and this makes me think that there really is something different with the ball. In general this year, the number of home runs that have been no doubters have been remarkable. Like there isn't, you don't very often see a home run, or you didn't during the regular season, where you're watching a guy go back on the ball and say, he's got a chance at this.
Well, you hit on two things that like sort of give me food for thought. One, obviously, interleague play, and that because you get to see these guys, or because you're at those stadiums.
And there's no difference in umpires now.
Yeah,
either,
no difference
right?
in umpires. You know, it does sort of like, it does negate the surprise, I guess, of the stadium factor. The other thing is that I think this is even, you know, this is not any shocking revelation, but it does show you the value of really high-end, top-shelf starting pitching that could sort of destroy plans. And at least in the last couple of games, you know, we have seen, and particularly last night with Cole, that like, you know, there was essentially not, you know, once he was able to get out of a little bit of that jam, that first and third, the Astros were in control the rest of the way. I think both of us believe the series is over. It seems inconceivable to me that the Nationals can win two games at Houston, given what we've seen so far.
Well, especially considering the fact that Max Scherzer, even if he does pitch, probably won't be 100%.
Yeah.
So that to me is a huge factor. But you know, the manner with which Houston dispensed with Washington at home makes me think that. And I thought the series was going to go seven games, but when you beat a team as conclusively in three consecutive games as Houston did, I think that's a sign that, I was going to say, the tide has turned. I really believe this, and I'm sure somebody like Tom Verducci will write something about this at the end of the World Series, but I believe in a World Series, in a longer series, in a seven-game series, the team's technological advantages really come to the forefront. I mean, we know that the Astros invest heavily in technology. We know that that's their thing. And when you've got all your available resources focused on one team or one group of hitters or one group of pitchers, you are more likely to find out a weakness, a tendency, a trend. And I think that's what we've seen in these three games. It's taken a while, but I really believe the Houston Astros have now leveraged all of their area of expertise into dominating this series. I'm not surprised. It's a very, much like the Nationals, they're a group of hitters that aren't afraid to be aggressive with two strike counts. And I think Carlos Correa talked about this yesterday after his home run. You know, he admitted, look, the more you see Daniel Hudson, and he's not criticizing Daniel Hudson. Right. He didn't mention him by name. But he said, the more you see the relievers, the more you see Daniel Hudson, the more you see Sean Doolittle, the more you understand what their pitches do. And that's especially the case when you're seeing a lot of pitches with guys, when you're fouling pitches off. And, you know, that's why I think there's this idea that this World Series was somehow going to be transformative and it was going to go back to, a reliance on starting pitchers and things of that nature. I mean, I think the only thing this World Series has shown is the danger of overexposing relievers. You know, there's a reason relievers are what they are. They're failed starters. Their stuff isn't good enough generally to go two or three times through. So don't ask them to go two or three times through a lineup.
What it does is it really shows you that when quality professional hitters get multiple looks at relievers, the damage that they can do. I will say that the Houston Astros lineup is really impressive.
Oh, it's a great, it's they a great
just,
lineup.
They remind me of all the great lineups that can go deep in counts, that take a lot of pitches. They're also, when they need to, aggressive. They have guys throughout the entire lineup that can hit the long ball at almost every position. So many of those guys, Jeff, are sort of either in their prime or young prime. It's a nasty, nasty lineup. Couple that with, obviously, those starting pitchers, and then they have a shutdown guy in the pen. It does not surprise me that the Astros will win this World Series, Jeff. What I am interested in is that, and not that this should matter at all, but do you, asterisk the wrong word, but will the Astros winning this year leave a bad taste in everyone's mouth except for those fans in Houston? What I'm trying to get at is, do you think Major League Baseball will be happy with the Astros winning? Certainly the guys on the field, they're an excellent team. They play baseball the way it should be played, but the whole series has essentially had this subtext outside of the field, and it's all self-inflicted by Houston. And I just wonder, you know, you want your champion of your sport to sort of be celebrated, even if, even if they're like a polarizing team. And in this one, that's not going to be the case. I don't think people are going to rub their arms around the Astros and feel great about them winning. Or maybe I'm just too close to the situation.
I always think the game is better when there's a dynasty and somebody to knock off their perch. Yeah, the whole the issue surrounding Brandon Taubman and that.
Overblown by me because I'm in the business?
I'm in the business too.
Yeah.
It's certainly, I don't want to give it short shrift, but I think it's pretty safe in saying that outside of the media business, the level of anger at the Astros is probably someplace between 0% and 2%.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I honestly don't think that the vast majority of baseball fans...
Maybe they don't even know about it. Might not even
attention. They can't help but know about it because everybody's been talking about it.
Right.
So, they'll know about it. I'm sure for neutrals, I think neutrals were probably cheering for the Nationals anyhow to begin with. What I think this does do is it takes the Astros away from being a celebrated dynasty, which, for the most part, those Yankees dynasties were. Easy to hate. Obviously easy to hate just because they were so good. But by and large, they made their reputation as a group of professionals.
Right.
Joe Torre was the face of that team. You have to have serious issues as a human being if you don't at least, like Joe Torre.
Total likable guy.
The problem here, I think, for the Astros is that, I shouldn't say maybe problem, what may separate it is, I don't think anybody can criticize A.J. Hinch for the way he's handled this situation. In point of fact, he was probably one of the few people in a position of authority in that organization that did what they were supposed to do. The players, this was an interesting clubhouse. A couple of years ago, this is a pretty, by baseball standards, they're not communists or Marxists, but by baseball standards, this is a pretty left-leaning clubhouse. Mm-hmm. This is a clubhouse where a lot of guys stood up for social issues. Guys like Lance McCullers. It was a clubhouse. Alex Bregman.
Bregman,
all fairly consistent in his criticism of the president. Like, it's not, again, I'm not turning it in. That's not like they're a bunch of rabble-rousing Marxists or anything. But it was a clubhouse.
For baseball, though.
For baseball players, they were pretty aware of things. Yeah. Let's put it that way. That kind of changed a bit when Roberto Osuna came on board. I think at that point, the organization kind of, it's pretty hard to say that we as an organization are doing anything other than trying to win when you bring Roberto Osuna in.
Yeah.
Whatever, I understand that the legal system took care of him and all that. But the point is, you bring Roberto Osuna in and you are accepting things. And it was, as Jeff Luhnow said, we like to think that we can bring somebody into the warm embrace of this clubhouse and make them a better person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the incident with Brandon Taubman, I think, really kind of puts the lie to that. They won't be celebrated. I think given the way baseball is right now and given the way that team is positioned, if they win, we can we have to at least open the discussion as to whether or not there's something dynastic happening here. But it's Brandon Taubman's gone, but Jeff Luhnow, anybody who knows him will tell you, he's fixated in one thing. He's a baseball guy. It doesn't surprise me that they would handle the situation badly, because I don't think Jeff Luhnow ever thought that he'd ever have to handle that situation. And more to the point, my guess is, and this is where I really have an issue with the Astros, and I've talked to people, my guess is the biggest problem with the Astros is nobody really gave a damn about it. Yeah, we'll just fire off a press release and away we go. Nobody thought about the bigger picture. And Jeff Luhnow's still going to be there. So unfortunately for Jeff Luhnow, as long as he's there, he has kind of become the face of an organization that needed 4 days to get something right. Well, like, you can get rid of Brandon Taubman, right, but you've still got the guy who needed 4 days to finally figure it out.
Well, two things there. One, they're never going to escape the fact that they tried to defame a reporter. There's just no, you're not walking that back. You fabricated a statement. You were incorrect in your investigation. And it took you, as you said, 4 days to ultimately issue
it wasn't until yesterday that the owner actually sent a letter to the reporter apologizing for defaming her.
Yeah, attempted to do, in my opinion, to be very blunt, is they tried to ruin a career. There's no, you can spin it how you want, but that's what they attempted to do, either maliciously or through ignorance.
I think through ignorance more than...
Right. But either case is awful. You did hit on something I think that's just interesting, in that their calculating and sort of coolness to this in terms of just how they approach it, like you said with Luhnow, he's just focused on one thing, and that's winning. The Roberto Osuna thing, I think, ended any kind of romance with the Astros. So you certainly have to respect, I think, just their intellect, how they build a team, their singular focus, laser focus on winning. But it is hard to, I find, Jeff, I find it very hard to embrace them at all as an organization. But I can't separate the fact that I have immense respect for the players, who I think even in this World Series weren't affected by anything that was going on outside of that clubhouse and have been fantastic the last three games.
Yeah, I don't. The players wouldn't be, though. This is the thing, and I know in a lot of the pregame media sessions, the question was asked of A.J. Hinch. Baseball, they're not going to be affected by that. Like, you know, there is no access, pregame access, to teams in the World Series. It's not like Alex Bregman has had 1,000 reporters ask him for his reaction to that incident. The end of the game, the story, the questions are going to be different. Like, I guarantee you there are guys in that clubhouse who haven't had to answer a question about that. So I'm not surprised that it wouldn't be a distraction for the players any more than, you know, A.J. Hinch a couple of years ago got in an altercation in a restaurant. They still went on to win the World Series.
Right.
I mean, stuff like that, I hate to say it, but I really do think that stuff like that matters more to us than to people in general.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, but I don't think, let's put it this way. I don't think baseball people feel any more differently about the Astros than they did before, because the Astros have always kind of had this reputation of being a bit of a bloodthirsty organization under Luhnow.
Right.
I mean, they've done a lot of things internally. They do a lot of things with their players. They've always had that reputation. But yeah, in terms of sort of the wider populace, absolutely. You know, I would think neutrals have gone from either not caring or just kind of enjoying the World Series to wanting the Nationals to win.
Yeah, and then lastly, just real quick, is just, you make a good point that athletes are, the reason why they are a lot of times professional athletes is they do have tunnel vision and nothing affects them outside of the field of play. So, you know, I didn't know that about the access to the World Series. That's interesting that they're not getting asked that before. It would lead to what you're saying, that, like, if they're dealing with post-game questions, those 99% of those questions are going to be about the game.
Yeah.
So that's true.
Your only access to the players is during batting practice, and it's very easy for them to walk by without answering the question.
Okay.
So, Jeff Merrick is host of Hockey Central, the NHL and Sportsnet, and Scotiabank Wednesday Night Hockey. We mentioned the Leafs split this weekend, a 4-1 win over the Sharks. That's a good news. a 5-2 loss to the Canadians. They were not very good in that game. And again, Michael Hutchinson continues to, there continue to be all sorts of red flags around Michael Hutchinson. You're saying the backup goalie, why are we worried about the backup goalie? We'll talk about that with Jeff Merrick. It's Writer's Block with Deitch and Blair on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and 360.
Subscribe to the Good Show podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, the Toronto Maple Leafs back on the ice against the Washington Capitals. Bit of an interesting weekend for the Leafs. They won 4-1 over the San Jose Sharks. I hate Friday night games in Toronto, by the way. They suck. Anyhow, 4-1 win over the San Jose Sharks and then a 5-2 loss to the Montreal Canadiens. Jeff Merrick is host of Hockey Central, the NHL and Sportsnet Scotiabank Wednesday Night Hockey 31 Thoughts, a nice surfing.
Stop. I know you. At this point, I know you're doing this to mock me. We've been on the air together so many times.
I know, but I just, you know what it is.
It's room, my, he'll sweep up too. I know. He'll pick up your dry cleaning. I know.
You know what it is? It's my Globe and Mail training. Because see, at the Globe and Mail, they're big on titles.
Sure.
Like the running joke was, if you need someone to quote in a story, find someone with the title. Like someone who's an executive director of some godforsaken two-person think tank. That's good. He's got a title. He's the executive director of the, you know, East, West, Chester, North, South, Left, Right think tank.
Everyone's
That's good.
Got a title.
So we got to go with titles.
Lemmy from Motorhead had a title. You could title anybody.
You could title anybody.
Sounds like a lot of television executives I know. Vice President of Programming and Strategic Operations for Fox Sports.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. I'm still panicking.
Why?
About the Leafs.
It's October. Look at the calendar.
I'm not really panicking.
A lot of back-to-backs, 14-game month.
Let me
talk you off the ledge.
Yeah,
a long season.
Here's the thing. You have to have won one game with your backup goalie in by now.
100%.
You and
100%.
I'm not blaming him completely, but I'm blaming him about 99.9% of the way.
This is, as we've seen, as bizarre as this may sound, and who might have been the best of all time? Bunny LaRocque, best backup goalie of all time?
Right? Absolutely.
We're all on the same page there. This is, in a lot of ways, the age of the backup netminder, as bizarre as that may sound. Where once upon a time, the backup netminder was there to just be cannon fodder, stand in front of 60 shots from Guy Lafleur and Steve Schutt. We know we're taking a loss. It's a 1977 Habs, but we need to put someone in there. We're not putting in our number one guy. But your backup netminder now has to win you games and has to keep you competitive. And as we all know through analytics, which tells you never play the same goaltender in back-to-back nights, because the numbers are not on your side, the pressure for a good backup goaltender has never been higher. Mm-hmm. And there are some teams, Islanders most recently, Dallas, Boston to some extent, that have been able to successfully platoon goaltenders. And now we hear goalies, even Henrik Lundqvist, we talked to him in Chicago, Elliot and I, about how much load are you willing to take on a season? Here's a guy who always wants to play, and he said, listen, I've had to calm my number down. I don't want to put a number on it, but he sort of danced around the number 60. And that's where most starters are at right now. But you can't just say, listen, our guy's going to give us 60 good starts. Our backup, well, if we squeeze a couple of wins out of him, great. If we don't, well, that's great too, because that's expectation. So to that point, Jeff, I'll agree with you 100%. You need to be competitive with your backup netminder in there more so than ever.
Because I'll let you jump in here in a minute, but because one of the problems I have is this idea that, and again, I'm not blaming Michael Hutchinson for all those losses, but we know what the Leafs are now. Travis Dermott's coming back. They may be a notch better defensively with him back, but they're not going to turn into a lockdown defensive team all of a sudden, I don't think.
It's not their style.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, that's why Freddie Anderson's so good, because he can play a lot of games behind a team that isn't a lockdown team and win them. And you almost need, clearly you can't get a backup who's as good as Freddie Anderson, but you do need a backup who's capable of stopping 40 shots with this team and winning.
Yeah. The thing about the Maple Leafs this season is, there's a couple things. One, the gamble is on skill.
Right.
Can we outskill the other team? We're not going to be a team like the St. Louis Blues that can leave you black and blue. And we're not going to be a team like Washington, who did same the year previous. The bet that the Maple Leafs have made is in 2019-2020, skill will prevail. And wherever we get a moment to improve ourselves with skill, whether it's fourth line right winger or first line left winger, we will do it. That's the bargain that, that's the bet that Kyle Dubas is making on this team. The second thing about the Maple Leafs is that all the answers come in April. Like all the answers come in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Like I know there are some teams in the NHL where they just can't get through the regular season fast enough. This is true of all sports. For this conversation, we use the Maple Leafs. Just need to get to the playoffs because that's where all the answers are held. There are no answers we need to find out about this team in the regular season. We'll grouse about backup netminders, and that's a legitimate conversation. You're bang on about it.
Because you're losing points in the standings that are going
to
hurt
you. Because you need to get there, right? And there's the anxiety about just getting to that spot because every year, you're right, there is one or two teams you expect to be there that at the end of it don't have a chair as the music stops.
If you finish a point away from avoiding the Bruins in the first round, you're going to look back at some of these games and go, come on.
I think the Leafs, for their own mental well-being, need to slay that dragon along the way.
Okay.
Mm. I'm one of those. Just like the Ottawa Senators years ago, as good as they were at getting to the Stanley Cup Final 2007, their white whale was Toronto.
Yes.
And we still have the Nieuwendyk throwing knuckleballs to Patrick Laline, and that has existed with that organization. There's never been a rivalry probably because of it. But I think all the answers exist in April for this team. Getting there is going to be awkward at times. We knew that the first 2 months were going to be challenging. October has 14 games, a lot of back-to-backs. November has 14 games as well. I think that the areas where they're getting exposed are rather obvious right now. We'll see how they go about correcting them. And I think you've isolated one, and that is the backup net mining position, as crazy as that may sound to some diehard hockey fans. Mm-hmm.
I might put my vote in, by the way, for Chico Rush. I know.
Chico.
I know Bonnie LaRocque is the de facto answer for that, but I do love
Chico and Billy. They were.
It was a good team.
Yeah, it's a good team.
Multiple Stanley Cup. But again, Bonnie.
He brought them back down 3-1, I believe, against the Penguins.
Obviously, growing up in Long Island, I saw a lot of him. He was an incredible backup goalie.
Yes,
it was essentially like having a really good one, and then a 1A.
We tend to think of Chico as the funny guy that does Chico.
Yeah, but he was
Prudential Center. You're right.
Back in his day, he was a goalie. So, Jeff, this is not really a contrarian kind of look, but one of the things that's interesting about all the evaluation of the Leafs, and I understand, I mean, Jeff totally hits on the right point about the backup goalie. The defense, I think, has issues. But so much of this evaluation right now is being done with their first-line center out. And I think people, I don't want to generalize. In my opinion, too many people have lost sight of the fact that they have lost their first-line center, and then everything changes, responsibilities, ice time, how you coach stuff. So to me, if these issues existed in December and January with John Tavares out there, I'd be a little more concerned. I do think when he comes back, and this is the case with any superstar coming back, a lot of times that player comes back and magically things get better, and there's a reason why things get better.
Ask Matt Molson how important John Tavares was with the Islanders. Ask Josh Bailey how important. Ask Bevilier. Ask Lee. Ask all these players, Kyle Okposo, all these players that got rich riding shotgun with John Tavares, like one of the best possession drivers in the game. Look at how different Mitch Marner is as a player.
Yep.
Without John Tavares here. I think you're bang on. I think one of the things that this spell has taught all Leafs fans is how important John Tavares is. He is the coach's dream. There is zero apprehension when Mike Babcock taps him on the shoulder and says, you're up next. And there's a reason for that. He is a workhorse. He is one of the best board players in the game. Like, if you watch him protect the puck along the boards, it's a clinic.
I know.
It's almost a masterclass. He can play the front net front position. He can play the bump position. He can play the one-time position. He is one of your most versatile forwards, and he is legit the most pro guy on your team and legit number one center. I think that's a huge one. If he's in your lineup and they're going through this, then I think you have problems.
The other one I want to ask you, Jeff, is do you have enough of a sample size right now to have a definitive opinion on Cody Ceci? And is he a top six defenseman, especially when Dermott comes back?
Not so much with the Maple Leafs, but if you look at the entire body of work, it's a very un-Kyle Dubas move to bring in someone like Cody Ceci, and it seems like so far this, I know they're working with him, based on the numbers that they have. And this is, you know, documented in baseball in the book, The MVP Machine. Mm-hmm. What do you do with this data? And how do you turn players into someone else, into a different type of player? And I know they want to work with Cody Ceci to get him there, but I don't know that they're anywhere close right now with this player, which is what makes the Travis Dermott situation that much more interesting. What is he now that he reenters the lineup tomorrow against Washington?
One of the other concerns defensively for the team, I think, has been Tyson Barry. Now, I don't know what people necessarily expected with Tyson Barry. I sort of didn't expect a repeat of some of his offensive numbers just because I don't know if he has to be that guy necessarily for this team, even though, you know, we have talked about how the Leafs are going to focus on skill. What have you made of his game so far, and what happens when Travis Dermott gets back, do you think, to the pairings? Do they stay as they are, or could we see Mike Babcock fiddle around with the pairings a bit?
To the first point about Travis Dermott, I think that they ease him in. I don't think they jump him in with big minutes right away, and I think it's a bottom pairing role, and then he works his way up. I think the hope, if you're the Maple Leafs, considering you may be losing three of your top four defensemen, that he takes a top four spot sooner than later. And then you have Rasmus Sandin next season. All of a sudden, a lot of your problems start to look a little bit better. As for Tyson Barry, when they made the move, I said one thing to myself: easy zone exits. Getting the puck out easily, either passing or perhaps better in Tyson Barry's situation, since he is a marvelous skater and makes reads really well, skating it out. The offense is the offense, and that's going to happen with Tyson Barry. No one expects him to be, you know, a defensive. No one expects him to be Denny Potvin or Larry Robinson. Like, no one's expecting that out of Tyson Barry. To me, if he's going to give you easy zone exits and quick transition on puck play, then Tyson Barry's doing his job. Still too early to say that. New coach, new team. Talk to me in December about Tyson Barry.
Because of his skill set, is that really one of those chemistry issues? You know, Jake Muzzin was talking about that on the weekend. And, you know, sometimes we have a tendency, I think, Jeff, to roll our eyes when people talk about chemistry. It's kind of a fallback position. In some cases, it's, I can't explain what's going on, therefore it must be chemistry. But when you have a guy with that skill set fitting into this team, you can almost see where it would take time for guys to read him, to sort of get a sense of why he's doing what he's doing, that sort of second nature stuff that comes only from ice time.
There's a lot of things, too. Let's not forget, too, this is a profoundly different coach. I mean, he comes from Colorado with Jared Bednar to a team with Mike Babcock behind the bench. And something even as simple as, you know, how you play two-on-ones. Like, where does Mike Babcock, does he want challenge the shot? Does he want to take away the pass? What does he want? You know, Mike Babcock, I remember talking to people in Detroit about this after Nick Lidstrom left. And their goaltenders would always be like, okay, Mike takes away the back door. Mike takes away the back door. If you look at the way the Red Wings always played, if you look at the way the Maple Leafs were constructed defensively, a lot of it is take away back door. And I remember, and Lidstrom was, listen, we all know Lidstrom was the best at that. Like, there was no one better at doing that in the game than Nick Lidstrom. When Lidstrom retired, the question became to the goaltenders, okay, are you still aggressive on the shooter knowing that Lidstrom's taking away the back door? And the answer was always, that's not a Lidstrom thing. That's a Babcock thing. And if you're not used to that, there is an adjustment period. We may think that they're all pros and they should be able to adjust to that quickly. At the NHL level with that pace, that doesn't happen quickly if it's not your default setting. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that is for Tyson Barry.
Jeff, it's early, but are you buying the Buffalo Sabres right now as a playoff team?
I'm buying them as a better team, not playoff. I mean, I've, like many of us, I've been false started on the Buffalo Sabres enough times.
Last year too, 10 in a row.
Yeah, right? Like, I don't know if I want to put my hand on the stove right now when it comes to the Buffalo Sabres. They're a better team. I think Ralph Kruger's done an amazing job getting his message through to those players. They're a team that's about to make a move too, and let's see what happens there. I mean, Marco Scandella seems to be the one that everyone circled, who's probably on his way out. They've got about a million defensemen right there on the back end.
Right.
Montour on his way. Like, they're a team that I look at and I say, this is a team in reflection. They don't know whether Tage Thompson is a legit NHLer. They already made the move with Nylander and brought in Jukka Harju from Chicago. He looks like he's going to be playing on that blue line for a long time. To me, that's a good move by Jason Botterill. I think the big question about the Buffalo Sabres still, to me, is Casey Mittelstadt, and can he be that second line center? The 2020 review is always, should we have had him up here for the full season last year? I think if you get him in a candid moment, anyone in the Sabres organization will say no, but what's done is done. The question now is, can he occupy that number two hole in the middle behind Jack Eichel? If the answer is yes, then I'm closer to saying yes, it's close to a playoff team. If not, then Eichel, it's Eichel and then a big hole in your second line center spot.
Mr. Merrick, we appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much for hanging around.
Thank you, Jeff. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Long day.
It's about to get longer. I'm doing a Dan Carlin event tonight at Hot Docs Theater.
That sounds like fun.
It's going to be good. For 2.5 hours, I don't have to talk about hockey.
It'll be great.
It's glorious.
Plus, and he's as you mentioned, he was on Bill Maher, so he'll have.
I know. He got chimped on time, though. He's going to make a point about polls. They ran out of time. Big Marshall McLuhan moment.
Oh,
the format that kills you.
I'm looking forward to it. It should be a lot of fun.
Thanks. Thanks, guys.
Jeff Merrick joining us. We'll take a break. When we come back, Richard and myself will talk about Southampton, the soccer team, and how they responded to being embarrassed. It's an interesting story. You'll want to hear it. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Subscribe to the Hockey Central podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Oh, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, Howard Bryant joins us at 3 o'clock. Amy Trask at 3:20. Michael Grange, our NBA insider, will be along. We'll have a Writer's Block roundtable with Davidi and Al Berga at 4 o'clock today. And a reminder that the Magic and Raptors game will be on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet. Tip-off is just after 7:30 p.m. tonight. The Raptors are 2-1. Taking on the Magic, whom of course they met in the playoffs last year. This happened just before we came on air, and thought it was kind of interesting. Southampton Saints of the English Premier League lost 9-0 at home to Leicester City on Friday, and it's the most lopsided defeat in
team history.
Premier League history.
Wow.
So today, the Southampton players and staff announced that they were donating a day's pay to charity. This is something that you sometimes see in soccer. I mean, there have been instances of teams that go on the road, lose badly, reimbursing their fans who've taken team transportation to the game. In other words, for example, Charlton Athletic puts on a bus service for their fans to go to games. And so it's relatively easy to find out who was at the game, present your ticket, you'll get your money reimbursed. The idea is that it comes out of the quote-unquote players' pockets. There have also been times, and again, I used Charlton Athletic as an example, where the team was taking the train back, and the team captain walked through a couple of coaches full of supporters and basically opened an account at the bar and said, any of these people wearing stuff, they're on me.
Nice.
So there is that sort of tradition. And your initial reaction is to think, good on them. I'm thinking, though, it's nice that they're giving money to charity, but as a fan, you take your chances when you go to a game. Guess what? There's a chance your team's going to lose. If you're a Southampton fan, you're frankly used to it. So the gesture is nice, but it's, someone asked on social media, can you imagine North American teams doing this? My response is, God, I hope not. Because this is the whole thing about being a fan. You are not guaranteed a win. You're not even guaranteed maximum effort. And if you're a Blue Jay, God almighty, if Blue Jays fans get in this, you go back and say, you owe me money because you started Edwin Jackson.
Gets into the whole load management thing with NBA players.
Kawhi,
Tim Duncan didn't
exactly.
play. I do like, I love the.
I like the gesture.
Yeah, I like the gesture.
I'm devil's advocate. Yeah, playing devil's advocate.
It's
here.
It's a very cool PR thing. It's a great gesture. I cannot in a million years see North American teams doing this ever. It just, I think the thought process is different.
Should they? And well, it's a difficult question. You're right. It is.
You would be acknowledging that your effort wasn't there, which in itself doesn't often happen.
Right.
You agree? Right. So that's step one. And then step two is recompensating someone, in this case, sort of the fans via charity, for that lack of effort. Again, I think it's a very cool gesture. It just doesn't seem to be, there's no tradition in North America of that.
Oh, God, no. I mean, the tradition in North America, frankly, is if your team sucks, well, we'll still raise ticket prices. Yeah. I mean, seriously, think about
Thank us. We're getting a better lottery pick.
Exactly.
But I will say this, Jeff. A team that did that would get amazing PR. You agree?
Yeah.
If you did it as a one-off, it might be worth it for the goodwill and PR.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Like picking up the expenses for traveling fans, I'm kind of okay with.
That's
you're probably
cool.
Talking a couple of hundred people.
Yeah, I like that. Actually.
And that, okay, and we're talking apples and oranges, I understand. You know, it's one thing to make a one-hour coach trip from, you know, to go and see your team play.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Another thing to make a 5.5-hour flight. I mean, North American sports fans don't travel the way soccer fans do, just because of the vast difference in geography. So I'm okay with that idea. You know, I'm okay with, hey, you know, we didn't play well, we'll reimburse you. But, and again, part of this is a devil's advocate position, because your initial response is to say, by God, this is good. Good on Southampton.
Do you want to hear my one quick idea that I think every team should do?
Yes.
I don't know. There's obviously cost issues.
Yes.
I think every professional sports team should pick one school, maybe it's an elementary school or a junior high school, and buy that entire school tickets for that week's game. Doesn't matter where they sit, because those kids aren't going to care. You put them in the upper deck. One, great gesture. Two, develops fans for that team at a very young age.
I think it's a horrible idea.
Why is that?
First of all,
Grinch.
No, first of all, it's night. I don't want kids.
All right, to make it Saturday afternoon.
I don't want kids. All the Saturday afternoon games the Raptors play.
I haven't thought this one through.
Wait, no, you have not thought it through.
All right, that's true.
First of all, generally, 400 or 500 kids in one spot is not a good thing.
What about if they're like fourth graders as opposed to like 10th graders?
Deitch, come on.
All right, I have to think this one
through. Why not fifth graders? Why not third graders? What are you doing about the second graders?
I know. That's a good point. I have to think about it.
Yeah, that was truly a bad idea.
But what about if it's like Toronto FC or Wolfpack or not like one of the big four? You still don't like the idea?
No, because they're sold out. They don't need to. They're making money on those tickets.
I'll think this one through a little bit. I was trying to do something charitable, but
no.
I can't say I thought it through. Marley's?
No.
No?
Why would you do that to the kids? Why would you subject them to American hockey league?
What's the third division now of the Premier League called?
What? There is no third division of the Premier League.
The championship
League.
Level.
The championship is actually
the second.
The
level.
Second, yeah. Yeah. And then there's League
third?
One.
League
and
One.
And then League Two.
League Two. Okay. How about League Two does this?
That was a bad idea. You just throw these things. That was a horrible idea.
Well, let's see if maybe some listeners have a better idea. Maybe they can take the germ of my idea and make it more feasible.
I'd rather be inoculated against the germ of that idea.
I forgot about the weeknight stuff. That's true. You could do it on a weekend, though. Listen, the Jays would be psyched to get 400 new fans this year.
No.
Yeah, we'll talk about this. No.
They do the kids thing. And I'm just kidding. I have no problem with 400 kids in one area as long as they're well-behaved. But
They let the kids run around on the weekend. I like that. They let them run the bases. Have you seen those, right?
Yeah.
That's a good little promotion. That's annoying. Really?
Yeah, it's annoying if you're in the press box writing because of all the noise. It's very bad.
Wow. I'm learning a lot. That's like the old
writer would be coming out. Generally, once a game's over, you just
you got a typewriter or a laptop?
Well, once a game's over, you like quiet. You know,
I agree with that.
But it can't
be that loud. I mean, there is a window in front of the press box. Where are you writing this stuff?
Jesus, Deitch. There's no window in front of the press box.
At the Jays? Sure there is. The Jays?
No.
Let me think about this.
It's an
outdoor press box? Is it?
God, you gotta get out more.
Yeah, I know. I'm 0 for 2 on this.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. Yeah, you're right. Now that I think about it, you're totally right.
Yeah.
You can go to that restaurant maybe and write. It's attached to the Jays, no? Boy, you're really disappointed in me on this Monday. I'll come back in the next hour.
No, it's just, it's. Again, if you're a fan... It's a nice gesture, but if you're a fan, you pays your money, you takes your chance.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. One thing I'd love to do is I'd love to do a little research to see if any North American team has done anything similar, where they've bought their supporters, like a large group of their supporters, something.
I doubt it. I don't think it's in the North American mindset.
I do love that MLS walk to the stadium. That's cool.
Howard Bryant of ESPN will join us. We'll talk about the World Series and the warm welcome Donald Trump got last night. Need a leg up in your picks? Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends for an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has those too, and it's free. Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks, whether you want to get it on the football action, tonight's hockey game, or anything in between. Go to oddsshark.net. This is not a gambling site.
If job requirements included having triggered a tantrum by a pompous, angry, multi-million-dollar athlete, they'd be unbelievably overqualified for the job. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So the World Series heads back to Houston with the Houston Astros leading 3-2 after three conclusive victories over the Washington Nationals in Washington. Gerrit Cole was a stud last night, and no surprise necessarily. But, he did answer a few questions, considering I think there was an indication after his previous start that his stuff wasn't quite up to snuff. Certainly looked good enough last night and was more than a match for the Washington Nationals. And now the Nationals and Astros head to Houston to finish off what Richard seems to be poised to be a come-from-behind World Series win for the Astros. It's awfully hard to see the Nationals pulling this out, especially if Max Scherzer isn't 100%.
The series is over, Jeff. I mean, I hate to sort of say that before the games are played, but I think that series ended last night in Washington.
Howard Bryant of ESPN is at the World Series. He's also author of Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field, which is coming in January 2020. He joins Richard Deitch and myself on Writer's Block. Hello, Howard.
Hello. I failed you both. I did not go to the World Series this year.
You didn't?
I did the ALCS, and then I came home.
Okay. See ya.
Thanks for joining us, Howard. Take care.
No problem. But you know, but
I did watch it all.
Well, this is something that I want to talk about in particular the umpiring in this game, because Howard.
Jeez.
No, Howard. I'm a guy who loves the makeup call. Like, I really do. I don't ever want robot umpires. I want
You're
umpires.
Joking, right?
I want umpires to make human mistakes, and I want them to even it up right away. To me, that is just, that's humanity. That's the best of humanity right there.
Or the worst.
I never thought, Mr. Blair, ever, that I would say, you sound just like Bud Selig. I mean, this is exactly the argument that he makes. Now, I am not saying that I prefer robot umps. I prefer good calls. And you're not going to get 100% good calls all the time. I understand that part. But can you really say that the score got evened? I mean,
no.
Obviously you can say, okay, well, you know, on the at-bat previous guy should have been out, wasn't out, and then so this one makes up for it. But does it really make up for it when it's just such a blatantly bad call? I mean, you really had a chance in the seventh inning to put the tying run on base.
Right.
I mean, the tying run at the plate, and Cole was going to be out of the game. I mean, that might have been the season right there for the Nationals.
Well, I got to tell you, I had a conversation with a veteran umpire one time, and we talked about makeup calls. And Howard, I think you'll get a kick out of this. His response was, because I said to him, two wrongs don't make a right. You know, we're always taught that, and he said, that depends on the count in the inning.
Exactly.
It's honest.
Well, and last night, absolutely. You know, case in point.
Yep.
Howard,
because it did get erased.
But we are going eventually to some sort of electronic assistance for umpires, aren't we? Like, this
Jeff,
is...
We were,
it's
we were
happening.
In the game we were in the game together in the late 90s. We both remember Questech. Remember Questech?
Yep.
And all the fans remember, you know, coming out of the strike. And all of a sudden, on your regional sports networks, there was that little rectangle above the, you know, on the strike zone. And it was always sold to the umpires as this is simply a value add that your local broadcast is doing so the fan at home can tell if a ball hits the strike zone. It's not being used as an evaluation tool. This is exactly the line that Major League Baseball told the umpires. Little did they know the umpires were using, I'm sorry, the Major League Baseball was using it as an evaluation tool. And today, I think most fans, when they're watching a baseball game, they look at that little rectangle and go, oh, it's just a graphic. They go, well, if it hits that box, it's a strike.
Yeah.
So 20 years later, you know, you've got a couple of experiments taking place in the Eastern League. It's coming. You can't tell me it's not coming. At some point, you're going to use some form of cyclops like they do in tennis where, you know, if the ball touches the net, it's a let, and they use a little electronic beep. There's going to be some form of electronic sensor system for that strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, multiple generations now of fans, Howard and Jeff, have seen broadcasters calling balls and strikes based on that box.
Absolutely.
As well. So they've essentially the fans judge the game based on that box. So I don't think it's a big leap then to go to some kind of electric umpire. Howard, I wanted to ask you something Jeff and I were talking about in the first hour, and that's sort of the legacy of the Astros. And
yep.
You know,
of this current group of Astros.
Of this current group. And our conversation was, as Jeff Blair was pointing out, that, you know, they're diametrically focused on winning. And that's sort of what Jeff Luhnow is about. You can't argue with how they've used data. You certainly can't argue with their results on the field. It's been extraordinary. But we were talking just about how a fan outside of Houston will process the Astros, and there's no romanticism. It just feels like, without sort of overstating it, there'll be a World Series winner, but you won't feel any kind of warmth for the winner.
And that is whose theory?
Probably the Astros' theory.
You think? I mean, I don't know. I got to say, Richard, I look at it a little differently.
Okay.
I mean, I look at this team, and obviously, number one, let's start with this. Number one, the chapter's not written.
Right. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
They might lose the next two games, and they might win the next two World Series. I mean, this team is still in its prime. So we really don't know what they're going to be yet. It's not like you're looking at, say, the 2011 Phillies or something where you go, okay, that run is over, and you can assess them. So who knows what they become? And who also knows what they become following not just the analytic sort of attitude that the organization has, but also the culture attitudes that they're having, both with the PR issues with Verlander and the Tigers earlier this year, and now with the World Series stuff or the ALCS stuff taking place and the World Series stuff. So there's that. But for me, I got to tell you, I love watching this team.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe it's also because I covered AJ when he was a rookie in Oakland back in the day or whatever, but I love Altuve's game. I love Correa's game. I love Marwin Gonzalez when he was there. I really like the fact that this is a team, when you watch them against the Yankees as well, and when you've watched their rallies in the games in Washington, they're not just a let's-hit-the-ball-over-the-fence team like the Dodgers and the Yankees. They are an incredibly versatile team. They play defense. They run. They hit for power. They pitch. And once again, in an era where we have openers and bullpen games and all of that, they've got two of the best pitchers in baseball, and you've got Greinke as well. So I think it really depends on what you choose to emphasize. When I thought about the Astros, and when I have thought about the Astros for the last couple of years, I look at them as a throwback team. I look at them as one of those teams on the field that I really, really admire watching. And I don't think that they're also that team of surly bad guys. It's not like they've got a McGuire or a Bonds or somebody on the team who sort of cast this surly shadow over them. They look like they enjoy playing baseball. I think it's a front office issue against what you see on the field. I really love what I see on the field watching these guys.
Good answer.
Yeah, no, and Howard, that was kind of my answer too, in that everything I'm told, I've spent a little bit of time around this team, a little bit in the postseason and previous postseasons. They remind me very much of the Atlanta Braves teams under Bobby Cox, and to a certain degree of those Yankees teams under Joe Torre, in that it's a professional environment to work in. There aren't, we don't know what these guys do when they go home. I mean, they may pull the wings off flies or throw cats in microwaves or stuff like that. But but by and large, we've all been there, Howard. But by and large, they seem to be a pretty decent group by baseball standards.
Well, absolutely, and it's not a bad clubhouse to walk into.
Yes,
I mean, obviously, you've got your baseball guys, you've got your surly guys, in the most part, but they're pretty, you know, as players go and as a team to cover. When you walk in that room, it's not a hostile room, and obviously, some of this has to do with just the difference in access and all of those things. But I also feel too that, you know, Richard's point is not something that you can dismiss either, because it is a front office game now.
Yep.
And we do look at these teams based on the front office attitudes, what they're projecting and how they're being projected. And they have not covered themselves in glory this week. They do not look like a likable franchise. They do not look like a likable organization, the way they've flubbed this. Sometimes I wonder how much the actual general public is paying attention to this, and are we paying attention more to it because it's our jobs to do that? So I don't know if they, you know, if they are going to walk out of this World Series win or lose with an attitude like they're the old Rangers or something, or like they're just they're a bad bunch of guys. I don't know. But I do think that there is a distinction there between watching them play. I mean, watching George Springer play in the postseason is kind of fun. I mean, this guy has decided that he is a postseason, he's a postseason animal. I mean, from what he did against the Dodgers a couple of years ago to what he's doing now. And if they do complete this thing, and I do think that they will win one of those two games, if they do complete this thing, what a comeback. And I think this is going to be something that people do pay attention to in a positive way. Now, obviously, we'll see what they do with it.
Howard, last night at Nationals Park, this was kind of a remarkable thing that happened, and that was the President of the United States received a lot of boos from that crowd, as well as chants of lock him up. The unsurprisingly, what happened last night has become now sort of discourse on social media, on Twitter, and nationally, and sort of depending on obviously where you stand, you can either in good faith or in bad faith talk about this in many ways. So, an open-ended question for you. When you saw that or when you read about that last night, what immediately came to mind for you?
Well, I think two things hit me. The first thing was that they also unfurled a banner that said, impeach Trump.
Right. And there was also Veterans for Impeachment.
And Veterans for Impeachment. And those things stayed up there for a bit. They weren't immediately taken down and people weren't ejected from the stadium. So I think that, number one, you're in a remarkable moment in time in the United States. And I think that last night may very well turn out to be one of those mainstream moments where people recognized what a critical moment in time we're in. This was not something like Donald Trump walking into some Democratic stronghold. I know he's in Washington, D.C., which is a major city, which, you know, is a heavily blue city. But when you're at the World Series, that is a moderate crowd because of the tickets involved, because of the people who get to go to World Series games, the people who can afford sporting events in general. So for a president to walk in there and to receive the reaction he got, who is under investigation, who has a national approval rating of 42.5%, that tells you what is happening here. I don't think he walked into an ambush at all. I think that you're looking at a place of massive dissatisfaction, of massive uncertainty, where even the most moderate, and baseball, as we remember, let's not forget, baseball is a conservative sport.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's not like he's walking into the NBA or something, where, you know, where the fans are going to, not even the fans, where the players are actually not going to be very kind to him. But baseball is a heavily Republican sport. And so for him to walk in there and to get that sort of reaction, it tells you this country is not just deeply divided, but, you know, you're a month away, maybe a little less, from a public impeachment hearing, which we've only had twice in the last 50 years. So I don't view this as, oh, well, you know, this is just, you know, just angry Democrats yelling at him. No, this country's a mess right now. And he walked into it and he saw what average mainstream people think about where, you know, about who he is and where we're at.
Mr. Bryant, we are going to let you scoot. Great of you to join us as always. I look forward to the book, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field, coming in January 2020. We'll get you on before then, for sure, for sure.
No, my pleasure, boys. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks,
Howard Bryant of ESPN. And the terrific Howard Bryant, one of our favorites and a longtime friend. Nice. I miss dinners with Howard. It's part of our dinner group. Him, Shinen, Passan, part of our dinner group.
Talented group. Passan and Shinen make the argument that maybe the two best sort of working baseball writers now with Verducci.
Yep.
Well, that's obviously subjective.
But, yeah, but no. And
I appreciate Howard saying that. And I do think, last night, Jeff, is going to, I'm not going to sort of make an overpronouncement, but I think it will be an impactful moment as we look back.
Oh, just based on how it was treated in social media, based on how it was treated in some of the conservative websites, social media sites, I'm with you in that. I mean, my sort of memories of presidents and World Series, and I was, Brunt and I were both at the World Series at Yankee Stadium where George Bush came out after 9/11.
Oh, wow.
And threw out the first pitch.
Maybe arguably the most famous first pitch in
just strolled
ever.
Out. Like, yeah, whatever you may say about George Bush.
Oh, yeah.
Just
incredible moment.
Balls in front, right?
Yeah. Just made going you feel great to be an American. Yeah.
And then I also remember Barack Obama showing up at St. Louis and getting booed.
Right.
And there was a great amount of debate in the press box whether it was because it was Barack Obama or he decided to wear Chicago White Sox.
Right.
White Sox jacket, which, if you know Barack Obama, then that's his team. So he was repping his team. But those are kind of the two instances. And I don't remember anything. I don't remember a scene in baseball like we saw last night with not just, political leaders get booed. It's kind of a thing to do. I actually think it's good to boo political leaders regardless of your stripes.
Absolutely. I'm with you. It's part of a healthy democracy. You're allowed to do it.
As Howard pointed out, to see signs go up, and those are signs that were brought in, to see signs go up and actually stay for a while, stay up for a while is,
The chant was essentially a recalibration of what has been chanted at Trump's rallies. That was as interesting to me as anything else.
Yeah, and as Howard makes the point, that is a... By and large, that's Trump's demographic, middle to upper class white folk. That's Trump's demographic for the most part that we're booing him. Amy Trask is CBS Sports NFL analyst. She's one of our Monday regulars. Amy Trask joins us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360.
Subscribe to the Lead Off Podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. More Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is Blair and Deitch. Michael Grange joins us at 3:40 ahead of tonight's game between the Magic and the Toronto Raptors, which we will have on Sportsnet 590. The Fan of Sportsnet tip-off is at 7:30. The Raptors splitting on the weekend. Week 8 of the NFL is, it will be in the books tonight. Officially put in the books tonight with the Dolphins. Playing the Steelers.
Sorry, horrible game.
Well, it is a horrible game. Some interesting results on the weekend, though, Mr. Deitch, and you've got a couple of questions right out of the gate for our guest, Amy Trask.
Let me give her a formal introduction. Yeah. Amy Trask of CBS Sports and the former head of the Oakland Raiders and famously the Princess of Darkness, as dubbed by Al Davis. What other? Are you the CEO or the COO of the Big Three? What is the official tag there?
Get ready for this. I am the chairman of the board.
That's a great title. You're a lawyer, so you must negotiate that title, right?
Well, I want to always, Deitch and Jeff, I want to always be absolutely forthcoming on your show. I do have a law degree. I am not a practicing lawyer. So it is a good title. I didn't negotiate it. But the title that means the most to me and always will is Princess of Darkness, and I hope with that you are just a bit afraid when we talk.
Absolutely.
Well, before I ask you my question about the Bills, I will say, if you are an Amy Trask fan, as everybody knows I am, go on Google and type her name in there and then go to Google Images. You see all these fantastic photos of her on the field with the Raiders in all black, totally trying to intimidate everybody. It's great. I'm talking about you in your 90s heyday when you really were into the whole Al Davis, let's intimidate everybody. That's my favorite Amy Trask era, 1990s Amy Trask.
First of all, I hope you're still intimidated. Second of all, I hope my heyday has yet to end. And next, I will note that while a lot of people look at me, because I still dress in black a lot, and they say, oh, right, 30 years with the Raiders, wear black. They're thinking Raiders. I'm thinking Audrey Hepburn. You know, the little Audrey Hepburn, black pants, stop at the ankle, little black top, pearls. I'm kind of going Audrey Hepburn, but it's still important that you're afraid, Deitch.
All right, I like that. You know, Hepburn is timeless, so I give you that. All right, listen, speaking of something not timeless, the Buffalo Bills. What are we to make, Amy, of this team? Their record 5-2, playoff team at the moment. Yet, if you look at them statistically and by the eye test, I gotta be honest with you, they're not one of the best teams in the AFC. But I get it; you are what your record is. So, when you evaluate the Buffalo Bills, what do you see from your perspective?
Well, my evaluation is, you know, almost verbatim what yours is. There's been a lot of hype around the Bills, both going into the season and when they started out as strongly as they did. But I don't buy into that hype perhaps as much or at all, definitely not as much as many others do. They are an improved team, but I don't think they're the team many people have declared them to be.
So, Amy, what has to happen to save Mitchell Trubisky's soul? Is there what needs to happen there? Because I mean, this is it's clearly a season slipping away from them. The Bears really do need to do a rethink about this, don't they? Or have they perhaps already started the rethink?
I think you're right in both regards, that they may well have already started it. It certainly sounds to some extent that they have. It was clear yesterday that the head coach did not trust the quarterback to get those few extra yards. And by the way, you know, people are arguing now about whether he should have gone for the extra yards or whether he should have just assumed that an NFL kicker can make a 41-yard kick. And those two things are not mutually exclusive. Sure, you should be able to assume your kicker can make that kick, assuming you have a kicker you believe can make that kick. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't also try to eke out a few more yards, whether running or otherwise. Those aren't, you know, we live in such a binary time where people think it has to be A or B when it can be a bit of both, or they're not mutually inconsistent. But it does seem that they're starting to rethink it. One might flash back to the draft at which they took him, and I am fond of saying, and I probably say it ad nauseum to the annoyance of many, the draft is not a science. There's no Rosetta Stone. There's no Enigma code. And that is just a quintessential example of the draft not being a science. But they do need to figure it out, and I think it's a combination of both the quarterback and the offense in which he's playing and the play calling. I think it's more than one factor, but they do need to figure that out.
So, you know, I was going to ask you about, like, the Niners, but instead of that, something has just occurred to me, given what you and Jeff were talking about, and that's kickers. In an age where teams have multiple millions of dollars, Amy, of resources to scout, all the data that one can possibly have, all the human capital in terms of looking at people, why still in 2019 do teams have such struggle finding kickers that are dependable? It's amazing. What is it with that position?
Well, a couple of things, and I am fond, you know, you just pitched that one. Since, you know, we're in the World Series, I'll say you just pitched that one slow and easy right across the center of the plate for me, and I'm going to swing at it. Because I get so frustrated with the crowd of people when I speak to the importance of kickers who say kickers aren't players, you know, kickers aren't real football players. Let me tell you something. When your game comes down to a field goal, as did that game we were just talking about, and your kicker either makes that field goal to win the game for you or misses, Don't anyone tell me kickers aren't important. Don't anyone tell me kickers aren't football players. When you see the rest of the team swarm a kicker and pick him up and carry him off because he wins a game. Games, you know, not all. There are blowouts. There are games that are decisive. But so many games are decided by so few points that if you have a kicker who misses a couple of extra points and or a couple of field goals, that can be the difference between a game or not a game. Playoffs or not players, I don't understand the lack of attention some teams pay to kickers, the lack of capital expended. And as to your question as to why they're not finding more, I don't know. But if you guys have sons or daughters who are really good at kicking, you might want to think about seeing how much they want to focus on that.
Amy, the Kansas City Chiefs, of course, with Matt Moore, lost to Green Bay last night, but they, I would think, getting Patrick Mahomes back, they've got to be pretty happy with how competitive they've been without him. I would think, because I think a lot of people viewed this as a test of just how good this team is on balance. And you know, Matt Moore finished off a victory over the Broncos. That was fine, and they were certainly competitive last night.
Sure, I'm raising my hand right now. You can't see me, but I'm raising my hand as one of those people that did not think Matt Moore would look as good last night as he did. I'm discounting the Bronco game a bit because of the quality of the opponent.
Sure.
And I shouldn't really do that because every game is a match. But he did look good last night. But what stuns me the most about Kansas City this year, and last night's a bit of an asterisk because Mahomes didn't play, was how many home games they've lost. In all my decades in the National Football League, that was one of the two toughest road environments in which we ever played. I'd put that one at number two, and the other, and they could go back and forth depending on the year, would be Buffalo. Mm-hmm. But Kansas City is an extraordinarily hard road environment. So I'm surprised by their home losses throughout the season.
You got time for one more? Quick one?
Absolutely, for you.
All right, thank you. Patriots going to lose this year or not? Regular season?
Oh, look, you know, it's hard to imagine any team winning every game. If any team can do it, that's the one. If they keep holding opposing offenses to as few points as they're giving up, they certainly can. But if you were to put the proverbial gun to my head and say, aim, quit equivocating, call it one way or the other, I would say no.
Amy, we're going to let you run. Thank you so much for joining us as always.
Thanks for having me, man.
See you, Amy.
Amy Trask, NFL analyst and CBS Sports. I like it when she says men.
Well, this is...
You know, just because you could see her, in talking to men, to football players.
Think about her whole professional career. She's so many times probably the only woman in the room given her powerful positions that she's held. So yeah, she does like that. She drops that. She says men a lot.
It's kind of a... But there's a welcoming aspect to it.
I will say this. Amy Trask, in person and on social media, is a very, very nice person. Tries to find the best in people, which is probably ironic given that she was mentored by Al Davis. Don't you think?
She's had a firsthand experience of dealing with bad people.
Yeah.
Although there was something refreshing.
No, yeah.
You know what? There was something refreshing about those old the badness of those old Raiders teams, because they were goofy. You know all the stories about,
like, I wouldn't call him bad. I think he, to me, Al Davis was very Jekyll and Hyde, right? Like the best of him was incredible. Integration, first guy to hire an African American coach, Latino coach, but also at the same time, totally paranoid, like the whole world's against me kind of stuff. So it's kind of really interesting.
I enjoyed those Raiders teams because
definitely.
They were full of lunatics that didn't have to sit down and figure out how to be a lunatic. The problem I have now is that a lot of what passes for sort of lunacy right now, I find is a little...
Staged lunacy?
It's a little much.
Yeah,
you know, like,
I agree.
What wittiness... What witty thing can I say today to tell people that I'm really off the wall?
Right.
You know, it's not like I think it was Skip Washington. I remember when the Raiders were in the Super Bowl, the first year Skip Washington was there. He wouldn't, and they were doing headshots of the players as they introduced, you know, they were lining up, the game has started, this is the Raiders defensive backfield. He did not want his headshot included because he claimed that a still photo would capture his soul. So they had no
headshot of him.
Right. Well, like, but like,
was, I mean, that, yeah, that, Ted now, that's legitimate lunacy.
Ted Hendricks and like.
Who was the offensive lineman that is.
Matuzak or was he a defensive lineman?
No, there was an offensive lineman. His paycheck had to be delivered to him by a remote control tank. It had to be taped to the top of the tank, and an assistant had to, like, it was a little model tank, had to navigate the tank over to his locker. Just that. Yeah.
These guys were all like Alzado, Stabler, they were like legitimate lunacy.
Yeah.
But they were really good football players. They had a sort of a perfect aesthetic for that time.
Ken Stabler's family, by the way, phenomenal Twitter fall. They've got like a Ken Stabler. No, it's really, if you're a fan of that era of football, which I really am. Like, I liked those Raiders teams. They were never my favorite team, but I loved Ken Stabler and I loved Dave Casper and just
goes to the post.
Fred Biletnikoff. They were just the
Cliff Branch.
Fred Biletnikoff, I covered him when he was assistant coach in the CFL and was just as much fun as an assistant coach as he must have been as a player.
Do you know the college wide receiver award is named after Fred Biletnikoff?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. The other, just real quick on them, Jeff, they had like two. Like generations of crazy, like they had the Matuzak, Hendricks, like Stabler, but then there was like Lester Hayes, like that group was also kind of insane too. Yeah. So like they had like a sustained 15-year run of like true, not like fake crazy, but like real crazy.
Yeah, and yet not over the line to the point where they would necessarily do violent stuff. I mean, Ted Hendricks,
except
I think
Jack had a couple, Tatum, right?
Except Jack Tatum, yeah, right. Jack Tatum was
right,
yeah. Yeah, but I mean, off the field as well, they managed to contain their lunacy to a certain degree.
But I don't think that Amy obviously would be the expert at this. I don't think that could have happened under any other owner than Al Davis.
No, I don't think so.
Because not only did he welcome it, I think he encouraged it. Right, living on the edge.
Well, he was a renegade, and I think he encouraged renegades. He was certainly not. He demanded a certain type of discipline. But it wasn't necessarily the militaristic discipline, the brush cut discipline you came to associate with the NFL.
By the way, there is no owner right now in the NFL like him. There is no one who goes against even those who are not sort of as, you know, over the top, sort of bowing down to the NFL mantra. There's no Al Davis anymore. They're almost all very similar billionaires.
It's
not even his son.
No, it's the only guy that I can think, and he's different stylistically, but. And the thing is, Al Davis knew football, too.
Yeah, the coach.
The guy that kind of comes to mind maybe in a way is Jerry Jones. He's different guys and different.
Yeah. Sort of a rebel for money, right? For commerce.
Yeah, but the same sort of football player.
Definitely.
A guy who understands the nuts and bolts of football as an owner as opposed to some guy who's just a sitting in a suit.
Because Jerry Jones played at Arkansas. He was actually a football player. So that's... Yeah, I mean, I don't know this off the top of my head, but there can't be many NFL owners who played college football. Jones has to be among the few, would be my guess.
I mean, yeah.
I don't think the Maras and the Rooneys, I think they were all sort of old money that bought in, and I'm not sure how many of the newer owners are former college football players. But Jerry Jones, whether you like him or dislike him, clearly the love of football has been there since he was a kid.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he might be the closest.
Yeah,
we have to Al Davis. Michael Grange is our NBA insider on Sportsnet. The Magic and the Raptors tip off tonight at 7:30 on Sportsnet 590. The Fan on Sportsnet. Michael Grange joins us. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Subscribe to the Leafs Hour podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590. The Fan on demand. Now more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
All right, our Monday roundtable is assembling. It'll be Shai Davidi and Nick Alberga at 4 o'clock. Pardon me, we'll get you set for tonight's Raptors game in a few minutes with Michael Grange. A reminder that your team could be playing in a game called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Yes, it is the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup. Your team was nominated. We've been asking you to tune in every weekday to hear if we announce your name. And if you do hear your team name, you have 590 seconds to call us and to qualify for the voting round of this contest. If you haven't entered yet, you could still enter online for a chance to be in the wild card or to be the wild card team, which is a team that will draw to be part of this competition. So Andrew Kahn from Barrie nominated the team Beast Mode, which is captained by Bob Watson. If you're on the team Beast Mode, you have 590 seconds to call us at *590, 1-888-666-0590, or 416-870-0590 to qualify for the voting round of this contest. Again, if you're on the team Beast Mode, you have 590 seconds to call us at 416-870-0590, *590, 1-888-666-0590. You can find full contest details on this and other contests at sportsnet.ca/590. The Magic are in town to take on the Raptors tonight. 7:30 tip on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. Michael Grange, our NBA insider, joining us now and writer's block. Michael, thanks so much for joining Richard and myself today. I mean, one of the storylines I think we're all going to be following early in the year is we're going to kind of be coaching along with Nick Nurse and trying to figure out what his rotation will ultimately look like. And, you know, we saw a little bit, I think, against the Chicago Bulls. We saw sort of a little, we saw Matt Thomas make a little appearance in the game and a cameo appearance. And the thing I was wondering as I was watching that game, Mike, is it's clear that right now we're in a process of seeing players sort of build up trust with Nick Nurse. He's got some new players in. He's trying to figure out who he trusts and who he doesn't trust. I got to ask you, what do you have to do to get Nick Nurse to trust you as a player?
Well, I think, you know, Matt Thomas almost gave like a textbook example where I think like any coach in that league or most leagues really, if you're not a superstar, you know, you're hired to do specific things. So execute on the things you're supposed to be very good at. If you're a defensive specialist, rim protector, do that. If you're, in Matt Thomas's case, if you're a guy who's been brought over from Europe to hit threes at a high rate of consistency, do that. So play to your strength, but while doing that, don't compromise what the team's priorities are. And clearly being able to be an able team defender is step one. And, you know, and various players are going to have various challenges with that. So, you know, you got Terrence Davis, who's very young as a pro. He's, you know, it's all coming at him really fast. How quickly can he figure out defensively what the basics are? Matt Thomas, a little more experience, maybe not quite the physical oomph that a guy like Terrence Davis or Stanley Johnson has, but can he provide the minimum? Can be in the right places, influence ball handlers the right way, know where his help is, all those kinds of things. So I think be good at what you're supposed to be good at and don't screw up the easy stuff or the basic stuff.
Mike, we're only at game four, but at a certain point, you can't run out just seven or eight guys to try to win regular season games because you're going to end up grinding your players, particularly those who are older, into the ground. At what point of the season does Nick Nurse have to have or at least have to commit to three, four guys on the bench who are going to see some kind of playing time?
Well, it'll be dictated by schedule a little bit, and as the Raptors start going on some longer road trips, it'll build up. You know, it's been kind of light lifting early on here. There's been off days and more than a couple of off days with the exception of that Chicago game. So he's gone away with it, but you're right. I mean, you know, if you've got a seven-man rotation, you know, this isn't the old NBA. You can't get away with playing guys 38, 39 minutes night after night, and not if you want to, you know, have something left in April and May and June. So, you know, I think it's going to be you've almost seen Nick kind of roll guys out on a tryout basis, bit by bit on the edges of that rotation. And, you know, so guys who, like Matt Thomas did as an example, as Terrence Davis has to a certain extent, prove that they can be trusted with those minutes. Well, maybe the leash gets extended a little longer and he's more willing to insert them in different lineup combinations and see how it works. I think the real challenge there, Richard, is how does he manage the minutes for his point guard? Because if you're starting Fred VanVleet, which seems to be the case, then it's going to be hard, I think, to really keep both Fred's and certainly Kyle's minutes down in that low 30 range, which is sort of deemed what's comfortable these days. That hasn't been the case through three games. I mean, you got lucky with a bit of a blowout on Saturday against the Bulls. But, you know, it seems like the two games against New Orleans and Boston, when things were tight, he wanted Van Vliet and Lowry on there as much as possible, and Siakam. And, you know, you end up those three guys playing about 40 minutes. That's a tough load. And you wonder where at what point he's going to be able to figure out how to mitigate that.
Mike, tonight against the Magic, this is an interesting game because while the Raptors ended up convincingly beating the Magic last year in the playoff round, now people quickly forget that first game of that series and how we were talking about the Magic's length and how we were talking about how much of a problem they were causing. And during the regular season last year, Mike, as you well remember, Magic played them pretty tough. What will you be looking for specifically tonight against a team that's really, really long and defensively could pose some challenges for this group?
I think the Magic are set up to give the Raptors fits. I really do. I think they're a bit of a sleeper team in the East. They brought back, you know, most of their roster intact. Like, they didn't really dive into the free agent market and try to shake things up. They're opting for continuity. That's maybe a little bit of Jeff Weltman, who, of course, worked with Masai Ujiri here in Toronto. You know, that's obviously the formula that's worked pretty well here, more or less, until recently. So I think they're allowing a group to gel and grow together. They've drafted very specifically for length. That's a formula that they believe works. And, you know, last year when you had Kawhi Leonard at your disposal, it wasn't quite enough. You know, now you don't. And so I think this is going to be one of those cases where, you know, Pascal Siakam was really good against the Magic last year, going up against Jonathan Isaacs or Aaron Gordon, whoever it might be. But now, as we've seen in the first three games, that's only going to be the first layer of defense. And yeah, somebody else is going to be coming. And that second defender is going to be long and quick. And, you know, Steve Clifford's teams are well-drilled, right? So they're going to be that much better on the rotations and everything like that. So I think the Magic, you know, not only just the Raptors, I think they have they're going to give the Raptors a test. I think they're a team that could really make some noise in the East. And, you know, the real variable there, there's a couple of them. They've got Mo Bamba in the lineup. He was hurt for most of last season, wasn't available in the playoffs last year, but he's a 7'1", super mobile, agile guy. They're expecting to be, you know, one of those kind of stretch five type players who can defend and step out. And now Markel Fultz is sort of like the NBA's grand experiment, right? Like, sort of, you know, showing some signs that there's still a little bit of that guy that the 76ers drafted number one overall a few years ago. And if they hit on either one or both of those two players, the Magic, you know, very soon will be a force in the East, I think. Mm.
Mr. Grange, we're going to let you run. I'll see you tonight, my friend.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Take Mike. Care.
Michael Grange of Sportsnet. Again, Magic and Raptors, 7:30 p.m. Sportsnet 590, the Fan of Sportsnet. It's funny, Richard, as Mike was talking. Los Angeles Clippers are now in their three games in the Kawhi Leonard era. And already Doc Rivers has had to put up with questions about load management. He took him out.
Played him really weird the other night.
Played him really weird. Yeah. He's got Doc Rivers' ideas. He's got to keep him to 35 minutes a night. He took him out in a game against the Thunder. They ended up losing.
Right.
And they had a 12-point deficit, got it down to 7, put him back in. They ended up going on to lose the game. But, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this, and I mentioned it in my column. Both John Gibbons and Felipe Alou, different sport, I understand. But their argument was always, hey, when you give a guy a day off, I don't want him in uniform. I don't want him with the spikes on. A day off is a day off is a day off, because it's way too tempting to put a guy in if he's in uniform. And I wonder, I understand Doc Rivers' thinking is, hey, he's a full year removed from that injury now. Load management is off. I don't think this is going to be as easy as Doc Rivers necessarily thinks it is. I think there are going to be nights where Kawhi Leonard just flat out will not dress for the game. And that's a way to do it, I think.
It is. I mean, to me, they should see what the Raptors' blueprint was and follow it. This notion. I know I've heard what Doc has said, and he's from the old school, right?
Yep.
Like, you play 83 games. He was a point guard for a lot of great teams.
Yeah.
But, like, they should be smart and keep Kawhi to 68, 69 games. The same way that Marek was talking about the Leafs, the season begins in April. Mm-hmm. Like, I would argue almost no team in sports, like, does the regular season matter less than the Los Angeles Clippers.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
They are built.
Absolutely.
Paul George coming back, they are built for one thing, and that's the postseason. Yeah. To waste this guy like 35 minutes a game on some dumb November game, I think is silly, but everything out of that Clipper camp, Jeff, is he's playing the full year.
Yeah, it's. I don't know if you had a chance to catch any of that game, but man, oh man.
I did.
Oklahoma City, they are having fun.
Yeah. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander looks like a player.
Yeah, they're having fun.
Is it wrong for me to want that guy to come here in a couple of years?
No, I'd be really down with that, absolutely. It is a Monday. That means we have our roundtable. Two of our finest, Nick Alberga and Shai Davidi, will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and on television. Glorious high def. In 360.
Subscribe to the Scoreboard Podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. When you choose to work with a deadline for your entire working life, you gotta be a little bit crazy. And crazy is great radio. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, it is the Monday Roundtable. Writer's Block, Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch, Shai Davidi, Nick Alberga. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on a Monday. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
So where do we start, Deitch? Where do you want to go? What's door number one? Do you want to the World Series? We got the VD. We can talk lease with Nick. Should we talk about Southampton?
I think we should talk about the... There we go.
Turn your button on.
Let's go really deep on the Raptors bench and just like talk about Rondae Hollis-Jefferson with these two guys. No, we should probably talk about, we'll start with the World Series, just given it is front and center. Shai, one of the things that Jeff and I were talking about, I feel like I've been roundly, beaten down on this, and I will concede that, I have very, how do I sort of phrase it? My romanticism for the Astros could not be lower. Like, I respect how they were built. I certainly respect the guys on the field. I think they're a fantastically composed baseball team. But I must admit, and I am totally biased here, especially because I used to work with her, everything that happened with Brandon Taubman and Stephanie Abstein has made me have so little respect for this organization. They're impossible, in my opinion, to root for because of the front office. That said, and as Howard Bryant pointed out, and I think as Blair pointed out too, that like, I don't know how many people really care about what I'm caring about. And I understand that you can respect the... just sort of the greatness of the players themselves. And the players are not reflective, at least in how they think, per se, compared to what the front office is.
Well, I think one of the many things that have really tainted this World Series is that because of that incident and a couple of the other things, I think the Donald Trump thing last night is another bad mark, regardless of where you're sitting.
Oh, come on. Bad mark? That's just great.
It's just a bad memory to have attached to this World Series that, you know, in these heavily partisan, divided times, that you can't even go to a baseball game to escape the nonsense of the American president. But that's another conversation. But there's just been a lot of gong show around this World Series. And that, to me, is part of the shame of it all. But I think from an industry perspective, Richard, I think you are voicing what the vast majority of people I've spoken to absolutely feel.
But we're speaking to media people, right?
But at some point,
not only media people.
At some point, everybody hates the smartest kids in the room, right?
But I don't think it's only that they hate. You know, the Rays are the smartest people in the room. People don't hate the Rays. Like, people admire the Rays. People have a lot. People don't hate the Dodgers front office staff, at least not the way that.
I don't think people hated the Warriors, right? No. I feel like they liked them generally.
Right. It's just the way the Astros have gone about it, the way that they've alienated a number of people. That's what's really stuck out with the industry, and people will hate that. Now, do the
can I just interrupt? And you're talking industry. You're talking about
like the baseball industry,
yes, scouts and other executives. Their human relations skills are generally flawed,
right? And that's just. I remember being at the GM meetings a couple of years ago, And, you know, one executive I was talking to said, oh, well, we were in a breakaway group with the Houston Astros and San Diego Padres, and I hope that the rest of baseball doesn't think that we're just like them. So that's some of the rep that's within baseball circles. But I think on the field, the general public, the players have a lot, the Astros have a lot of players that are easy to identify with and admire and respect, from Altuve, Correa, Springer, Verlander, Gerrit Cole. I mean, they're just a tremendous, Alex Bregman's a lot of fun. You know, this is a good roster with largely good people. I think the general public can wrap their minds around that. But I think there is a taint to the way that this front office has gone about things in general. And a lot of that just bubbled through the surface.
The one thing I just want to add real quick, Nick, I know you want to jump in, is that one thing that the Astros have shown, Shai, is the hypocrisy of what their sort of philosophical charter once was, which was, we're going to win a certain way. We have a no-tolerance policy on certain things, which they broke when it came to Roberto Osuna. Now, that has turned out to be, at least in terms of sort of asset, a smart move. But they were, unless you guys can correct me, were they not very public about the fact that they had a no-tolerance policy about DV?
Right. They had a double-A player who was caught in a video assaulting his, I believe, girlfriend or wife, and it was a port, and he was released and was like, we've got a zero-tolerance policy for this. Now, I will say that the Astros kind of set that as a bar, but really the guiding principle of the way they operate is to find inefficiencies and exploit them. And acquiring Roberto Osuna at the price that they acquired him for was an inefficiency.
There was nothing moral about it.
And there was no, what is the human impact of this? Just, this is a numerical decision, and it was overwhelmingly in their favor.
Nick, I want to bring you in here on this too, because the New England Patriots went out and got Antonio Brown. Now, he's not with him anymore. If the New England Patriots win the Super Bowl, are people going to think less of them because they went out and got Antonio Brown? Like, what I'm saying is, I'm not giving Roberto Osuna any pass here, but he's been dealt with by the law. He's been moved out of this environment, traded to another city. As far as we know, there's no evidence of anything untoward with the Astros, right? I mean, he's whatever. He's just kind of gone on and done his thing. So I guess my question is, because an assistant general manager said something very offensive to a group of reporters, and because the organization's front office sort of doubled down on the jackassery of it by claiming that the writer was essentially had essentially lied. Like, I don't know if there's a double standard at work here. You know, the NFL seems to skate by, quite frankly, a lot of times when it comes to things like this. This is kind of a rare incident for baseball. This is just another week. You know, 2 years ago, this was another week in the NFL.
I think you guys are totally right. And, you know, as somebody who doesn't watch football as much, one of the reasons is why is because of that. I can't stand for, I understand teams and I understand the mentality. We want to win and at any means possible, but I think there has to be a line. And on that note, I mean, you know, the representation or not, you're representing a team.
And so
I think you have to have the ideology out there. I do think it's easy in my world, at least, to have the disconnect. I understand the players don't have much to do with this. I understand they're correlated because it is their team. But as just a baseball fan in general, I have disconnected the two sides because I think that's the right thing to do. But I do agree with you guys fully. Like, I, especially in the NFL world, I have a tough time watching that league for a variety of reasons. But among them is certainly the fact that you can do anything and still come back in the league, which is disgusting in my opinion.
Well, I'm sorry, Jeff. I was just going to say, the one thing about Antonio Brown, it is important to note, is that when the Patriots acquired him, we had not at that point heard the allegations, sexual assault allegations. He's also no longer with them. All that said, Jeff, you are totally right. What is accepted in the NFL, I would argue by fans, is criminality. Mm-hmm. They don't blink at it unless the criminality is so hard.
Unless it costs their fantasy team points.
I would just say unless the criminality is to a point where it is so offensive
Ray
to
Caruth.
The league,
yeah.
Right, where that's when sort of discipline happens. You are correct that I would almost argue almost every other sport does not get that kind of leeway from its fans when it comes to criminality. I could be wrong on that, but that it feels like that.
Fair. Well, I would say to you that there's an interesting analogy in baseball, because a few years ago when the Chicago Cubs won the World Series, they went out and acquired Aroldis Chapman right. at the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And he had had the incident in the spring in the fall, and it scuttled the deal that was going to send him to the Dodgers. Instead, he got sent to the Yankees, who subsequently flipped him to the Cubs. And the Cubs were like, people didn't rake the Cubs over the coals. And within the span of a couple years, the discussion, at least in baseball, transitioned to the point where the Astros essentially do the same thing at the deadline and they get crushed for it. And they're still
That's a great point.
And they're still really dealing with the fallout.
Well, and was it Farhan Zaidi who came out
when
he was with the Dodgers said we would not have acquired Roberto Osuna because of that.
And Dave Dombrowski hinted at the same thing.
Exactly.
And I think there were other front offices. I talked to a scout from another team and he said before Osuna was traded, and he just said, look, he's just nuclear. We can't touch him.
And listen, the Yankees absolutely skated on this. One, they got an incredible player for Chapman from the Cubs, like a Gleyber Torres, right? Okay, so they basically got a potential, I don't want to be crazy here, but like a Hall of Fame caliber type of talent. Then they reacquired Chapman, and I would argue got nearly any of the blowback that the Astros did.
And the Mets didn't when they reintroduced Jose Reyes. Right.
Correct.
Or with Yeris Familia afterwards. It's interesting that in that market, there was none of the outrage that there was in Houston at that point.
I know we've talked about this before, Jeff. Once again, I would say professional sports does not take domestic violence seriously. It just doesn't. Like, there are, you get the lip service, you hear from leagues that say, here are our programs, we take this seriously, but time and time again, if the player in question is enough of an asset for a team, that player continues to work. The only league that has shown me that it's at least a little serious about it is the NHL.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because Voinoff is not in the league and essentially has been either by the letter of the law or sort of collusion-wise, has essentially been blackballed from the league.
Yeah, and I mean, to that point, it doesn't happen very frequently in the NHL world, so they don't have much to go on. But I think you're totally right in bringing up Slavovoinov. That said, we have seen in the last couple months there is a path, an openness to maybe having Voinoff back in this league. And I think as, you know, leagues in general have become numb to the situation because it happens so frequently, which isn't right by any stretch. Like, I don't even know, you know, sort of the parameters you have to set in place, but I totally agree on the front that from a fan perspective, people don't even pay attention to that, which is not right. And again, getting back to my point, I can't even watch the NFL for a variety of reasons, but a lot of it is because of that. And I do feel the Astros should be shamed for the situation. Any team that because I understand, like, you know, money makes people talk and money makes you happy and all that stuff in a business. But to go to that, you know, extreme and that level to acquire a player or anybody, you know, surrounding a situation like that is not right, in my opinion. And certainly I think something in this society is not talked about enough as to, you know, the impact it should have on us. Mm-hmm.
Right. And just to double down on that, mm-hmm. there are two things happening in Houston, right? There's still whether or not Osuna was the right thing to do and how they've handled the Osuna acquisition. And what happened after they eliminated the Yankees is separate. That was somebody essentially harassing a group of reporters, but one reporter specifically, wearing a domestic violence awareness bracelet for having an issue with that trade. And if you're going to make the acquisition of Roberto Osuna, that's fine. But you have to understand that you are acquiring the baggage that comes along with it. And that was a moment where it was just a moment of pure vindictiveness, of trying to lord over his power against someone who had a differing view. And that is what made that incident so repugnant.
Major League Baseball is not done with the Astros yet either, are they?
No. There's supposed to be some sort of resolution to the to their own investigation into both what happened initially and subsequently what went on with that statement. So I'm sure that that's not going to happen until after the World Series is done.
I don't think any of us like playing, judge, jury, and executioner. But what is even a just penalty for that? Like, is losing draft picks? Is it some kind of financial penalty? You know what I mean? Like, it's so.
I would think it'd be a financial penalty. I don't know if you can take draft picks.
Which will be unsatisfying. Right? I'm not saying I have the answer, but I would almost argue that almost any penalty they get will prove to be unsatisfying.
But you still have to levy a penalty.
I agree with you. Yeah, right. For sure.
And you know, ultimately, to me, the best thing they could do is to take a penalty and then have the money diverted to some sort of group that works against domestic violence and have there be some more engagement on that front and trying to support groups directly working with victims of domestic violence. And maybe that's a way to accomplish a little bit of good out of what has been a very bad situation.
This is for both you and Shai really quick. This is very sort of inside baseball, but should the Astros public relations department, the person who put that statement out or greenlit that statement out, one, should they still have that job? But two, as a baseball writer, can you ever trust them again?
I don't know who put out the release. I'm hoping it wasn't just put out by the PR department and nobody looked at it. I tend to think that somebody had to look at it, that somebody had to green light that.
And I would think that that's coming from above the PR department.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked with all those, that group, with all of them over the years. They're generally very courteous, very helpful. I know I have a handful of friends who cover the Astros, and I know that they've had their run-ins on certain things, but I think that's common with anybody on a beat.
I think what the issue with the Astros is, Astros PR staff is, that if there is any, is it's a small market. There's really one or two writers or reporters covering the team. This is a big stage, but I don't think that it was the same guy doing the game notes who sent this out. I hope it wasn't. If that was the case, then quite frankly, somebody above him needs to be fired, because that's
this is above the PR department's pay grade. It's not uncommon for the PR department to go into situations saying you should do A, B, and C, and they're like, no, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I think the question that we need to know is, who did sign off on it?
Mm-hmm.
Did it get all the way up to the owner, Jim Crane? I don't know. Jeff Luhnow, Jeff Luhnow tends to have blinders on. I can almost see him going, yeah, whatever. Or is there somebody else in the business public relations department did it?
I mean, Jeff Luhnow did say that he did look at it before it went out, as did a group of them. But I think with something at that severity, at that point in time, if that's not running across Jim Crane's desk, I would be stunned.
Yeah. Mm. Let's talk about the games themselves. The Astros are leading 3-2. Pretty conclusive sweep of the Washington Nationals in Washington. It was a 4-1, 7-1, 8-1. Max Scherzer's hurt. Don't know if he's going to pitch game 6. Don't know if he'll be available for game 7, obviously. Think this thing is over, Shai?
I would think so, but, it's a pretty tough task. Steven Strasburg can certainly shove for 7 innings and send this into a game 7. And then if Max Scherzer can get back for a game 7, all of a sudden all bets are off. So I think tomorrow is the day, if you're the Astros, tomorrow is the day you've got to get it done. But to me, the longer this series went, the more the difference in depth between the teams was going to reveal itself, and that's really what's happened.
Yeah,
I love the fact that the numbers were strongly in favor of the Nats. You win two games, the first two games on the road, like it's over, right? And the Astros, it's like they showed up and said, you know what, we're going to flex our muscle now, and we're going to win this series. And ultimately, I do think clearly they're the better team. Gerrit Cole is out of this world. I can't wait to see what he gets on the market. I was talking to Shai before we came on air. Like he has been unbelievable this year for this team, not only in the postseason, but in the regular season as well. And I think from a standpoint, I just think the Nats have run out of, I don't even know what the word is, but they were on such an impeccable run for a long period of time. And I think they just lost that pixie dust, so to speak. Like, you score three runs in three games, and you still, the fact that you still have to run into the big guns of Houston in the last couple games here. They're riding momentum. Carlos Correa goes deep. Alvarez, you know, Bregman hasn't even caught fire yet. Like, there's a lot of factors as to why I think the Astros have this done. I'm not sure how much the Nationals have left. And again, they're really, really struggling at the dish too.
Shai, I'm wondering if we've got two teams that have great two-strike approaches, clearly not afraid to hit with two strikes or find themselves in a position where they're with two strikes. I wonder if what we're not seeing is something Carlos Correa talked about yesterday. Dave Martinez has got a pretty small, Brent uses the phrase, circle of trust with his pitchers. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the Astros just haven't seen such a steady diet from the same guys over and over again that they, you know, they've got them timed. They know what's coming. It's just not as much of a challenge for them as it used to be. You know, you get Daniel Hudson 3 days in a row.
Right.
You're probably going to have an idea of what he's going to be doing.
And we should also remember Daniel Hudson, credit, full credit to him. He's been great for Washington and he was great here with the Blue Jays, but he was unemployed in the last week of spring training.
Right.
And he wasn't able to pitch for the Dodgers in the postseason last year. You know, it's not like we're talking about an all world reliever here. We're talking about someone who was acquired for, you know, a single A lottery ticket who may never get to the big leagues. So, you know, you have to kind of, that circle of trust is especially small and it's not deep once you get past the initial big three. And to me, one of the turning points of the series, and obviously we'll never know, but is Patrick Corbin more effective in game three if he doesn't have to throw that inning mm-hmm. in game one? And the fact that you needed him in game one demonstrates just how thin you are and how little margin you have. And I wonder if that doesn't sort of, you know, if Patrick Corbin is full go, you know, is that game different? Then all of a sudden the entire series is different.
Yeah, and the only thing, and it's a good point, Chad. The only thing I'll say, and again, not to write the obit already on the Nationals, although I think everybody in this room agrees that the series is over, but, you know, if you have a little bit of perspective and just step back to the beginning of the year, this has been an incredible year for the Nationals. They lost Bryce Harper. There were many people who didn't think they were going to be a playoff team or at very best a wild card team. They went on to have an incredible NLCS run. And they are up against a team that I think is a better team than them. They have better starting pitching. They're deeper. I think their lineup is better. So they've had a tremendous year. And they have pretty much, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but most people are back. Like that, they I feel like will have built something sustainable over the next couple of years.
Both of these teams have got...
Well, yeah, for sure, the Astros
Garrett Cole is well, I mean, he's eligible
still,
to go, probably.
Great minor league system. They'll have guys come up. But I do tip my hat to the Nationals. I think they've had a phenomenal year that, if you have a little perspective and go back to April, not many people saw this.
Yeah, it's just a thing where there's no second place trophies, right?
I get it. And you won the first two games.
Yeah, like, I love the narrative. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a big Bryce Harper guy. I just don't like how that ended. But the fact that that organization moved on from that, and I get it, they didn't want to throw the money, but I think it's an impeccable story. When push comes to shove in 5 years from now, they're still going to say, and again, we're not writing the obituary. You never know. They won the first two games on the road. But to think back, and as you illustrated, they were up 2-0 in this series with their pulse on the series, and then they couldn't close it out. Mm-hmm. Has to be so disheartening, because we've seen in this market too how difficult it is to get to that juncture. I still lose sleep over the Blue Jays back-to-back years. Like, they were so close to just getting there, and then you never know what's going to happen. So ultimately, while I think your point is very well taken, at some point in time you're going to think back and say, what did we really accomplish, right?
Yeah, I mean, they let it get away, but I also just think they just didn't have the roster depth to compete. Yeah. I mean, if you're counting on Anibal Sanchez to win a game for you in October, I mean, you're in a bad spot, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens with them, because Rendon is a free agent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Strasburg can opt out. So, I mean, those are two major pieces, but they did navigate the departure of Harper really well, and they're set up with, you know, a couple key Soto and Robles, and still have Trey Turner as a nice player. Zimmerman is starting to get towards the end, but, you know, they've got pieces there to stay competitive, but to be honest, they should never have gotten past the Dodgers, you know. And if that, you know, if the baseballs aren't a little different in the postseason, Will Smith ends that game of the night against mm-hmm. the game five in the ninth inning, you know, that ball falls a couple feet short of leaving, And we're talking Dodgers-Astros in the World Series right now.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll turn our attention to the Toronto Maple Leafs, the gift that keeps on giving. It's Writer's Block, the Monday Roundtable on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360.
Subscribe to the Tim and Sid podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, it is Writer's Block. Clean it up, boys. Sportsnet 590, The Fan of Sportsnet 360, Shai Davidi, Nick Alberga. What is the golden muzzy, by the way, your twiddle?
You asked me this last time I was on.
Okay, did I?
Yeah, Roger Lajoie, the whole connection. I had a new media class with Roger Lajoie at the College of Sports Media.
I didn't know, and that's where the golden muzzy came from.
Well, it was Movember. I take part in Movember. I think it's for a great cause, and
you can do it.
My muzzy comes in a bit like yellow, so okay. I didn't know what to think of at the time for a Twitter account 11 years ago. So it's like the golden muzzy, and it's stuck.
All right, okay. I see. I don't remember asking that question.
Next time,
we're close to Movember. You're gonna grow a mustache?
No, no,
I can't.
No one needs to do that.
I can't either. Anyhow.
The good old Davidi, Matthews. Well, the Austin can, Matthews.
What? Yeah, the Austin Matthews. Yeah.
A little tickler.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's where we're going. Speaking of Austin Matthews, so the Leafs beat San Jose 4-1. Great defensive game, good defensive effort, all that good stuff. Then they go to Montreal and lose 5-2 and look an awful lot like the Leafs usually do when they're not playing well, Nick. Yeah, we talked to Jeff Merrick a little bit about the Michael Hutchinson and the whole backup goaltender issue in Toronto. And people laugh when you say it's an issue, but I think as Merrick said, it would be funny if it weren't for the fact that backup goaltenders are now really important. You know, it's not like it was 20 years ago. Backup goaltenders, you have to win games that they're in now. The league is that close. But what I'm particularly interested in, Nick, is Tyson Barrie, because this is a guy that came over. I think a lot of people thought he would be the antidote to a lot of the issues surrounding the Leafs, not defensively, but the fact that he's a right-handed shot. I mean, he just seemed to be a guy who would fit perfectly into what Kyle Dubas is trying to accomplish. High skill, quickness. You know, he's got the shot as well that the head coach likes. Have the returns been mixed on Tyson Barrie so far, or are we being a little too is our focus on him a little misplaced?
We're being very Toronto. I think when you look back at that trade, Nazem Kadri's been great with Colorado, don't get me wrong. Alex Kerfoot, I don't even want to call him a surprise because I knew a lot about this guy before he came here. Like, he brings a lot to the puzzle, scored over 40 points in his career in a season, third line center. Like, he's a perfect fit there. When it comes to Barrie, I always had my reservations on acquiring a player like that because, again, I don't think he's much of an upgrade defensively. And I think he's restricted in terms of how much points he can put up because of Morgan Rielly, right? Morgan Rielly gets the first power play unit, four other forwards there. I'm still in the small community that they should mix up the power play. To me, it hasn't been anything outstanding so far, especially the last couple games. They've been dreadful at times. I understand John Tavares is out of this lineup. But I would love to see Tyson Barrie get a shot at running that first power play unit. He's got a lot of great qualities that you want in a puck-moving defenseman. Shoots right, set a lot of exposure to Nathan MacKinnon, Landeskog, Rantanen, and the great guns, as we know, in Denver and with the Avalanche. And I think that was, you know, what I wondered about with Barrie coming to Toronto is the exposure level, especially, again, with Morgan Rielly. I think we can all agree the better defenseman, but from a point-producing standpoint, you know, Tyson Barrie does have a pretty strong resume in running a power play and leading a team from the back end and headmanning the puck. So I think we're looking too deeply into it. Certainly, I always like to bring back the comparison to St. Louis Blues last year, right? It took them like 40 games to find their footing. Let's not forget how active Doug Armstrong, their GM, was last offseason previous to winning the Cup last year. They made like so many changes. You look at this Maple Leafs team, there are a lot of notable changes on this roster now, namely in the bottom six, but on the back end, even Jake Muzzin comes in around the deadline from LA. the Berry acquisition. Like, these guys are still trying to figure each other out. And I sort of laugh working in this market, but I understand we're just 13 games into this thing, right?
Well, and I also wonder, Nick, if, you know, it's one thing to bring guys in and sort of try to make the chemistry work when you've got a guy who's got a lot of skill and maybe a guy who's not as skilled. But it seems to me that you, when you bring guys in and you focused on bringing in players that are quick, that have some skill, that have a little bit of offensive touch, you're talking about more skilled players. Therefore, it's probably going to take a longer time for those skills to all mesh together than if you're just bringing in like a steady stay-at-home defensive defenseman, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, I think the debate will rage on all season long. Again, it's the last couple games. The narrative has begun again. Do they have enough bite in this lineup? And I still wonder. You look at Austin Matthews, got laid out by Brendan Dillon on Friday night. Saturday, Max Domi.
Tyson Berry was hit by Max. Was it Kerfoot?
Right?
Somebody hit him with the shoulder. Right, it was Kerfoot.
Berry got hit too. Like, I mean, that is going to be a big wonder for me as the season goes on, and we are in the age of data and analytics, and I do think it is a important tool in the NHL especially. But I'm not sure about the composition of this Leafs team from that standpoint, where guys are now taking liberties on some of their star players. Granted, I think there is a way to address that situation. My perfect correlation is Sidney Crosby in Pittsburgh stood up for his teammate a couple weeks back. I'm not saying, hey, Austin Matthews, hey, John Tavares, hey, Mitch Marner, go out there and scrap somebody to defend your teammate. But just showing that will to win and the fact that you're going to go to battle for anybody up and down that lineup goes a long way in not only the fans' perspective, the media perspective, the coaching staff, the opponent, right? And yeah. I think that's what we're missing. I don't think I'm, you know, saying, hey, let's go out there and get a tough guy to protect these kids. I think internally this Maple Leafs team can be much tougher than they're leading on right now.
It's a great point, Shai, too, because that is the one, I don't know if you'd say a knock against Austin Matthews, but the one thing people have pointed out is he's big. He's strong. We've seen how hard he can be to move off the puck. You'd like to see, and I understand he's got a history of shoulder injuries now, so that has to be factored in. But I think you'd like to see a little more willingness to shove somebody after a whistle or to sort of, I'm going to say stand up. I don't ever want him fighting because, you know, you don't want to end up with Austin Matthews out for a month because he hurt his shoulder throwing a punch at some slug. But at the same time, I think there has to be a willingness to sort of hate the same man up, but the man up every now and then.
Well, I agree in principle, but I think that sort of thing has to happen organically. And where you get yourself into trouble is if you try to, by design, I'm going to put on a show for my teammates and I'm going to demonstrate toughness, and maybe you do it in the wrong way and either you get injured or you do something that leads to some discipline, and that's the worst situation to be in. Okay, I think this is going to hang on their heads for a while. And I think for the Leafs, there are two things going on. It's like, do you want to be kind of, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, wasting your bullets right now, game 13 of the mm-hmm. of the regular season, or do you need to really show that and sort of sacrifice your body and really give it up once you start getting closer to playoff time and the separation in the standings has revealed itself to be what it is and the games are carrying more stakes? I think there is a feeling process out right now that's taking place. These guys are trying to figure out what we want to be, how we should be playing, and you know, I think that the more important thing is that they start building and trying to find a bit more consistency in terms of an identity that's a little bit different from what's they've been the past couple of years, where, you know, they've consistently been a team that you can exploit defensively.
Right.
That, to me, is where there's a more important sort of measure of toughness in terms of, you know, we're trying to figure out how we're going to play and we're going to show that we can do these things consistently.
I feel like I should be using the word truculence just in honor of my word. I love that word. You know, my take on them, and Marek was here. I thought he addressed it and illuminated it really well. They're, you know, we're 13 games in, but we really haven't. Whatever this group is ultimately going to be come April doesn't exist yet. Like, Dermott has to come back. Obviously, Tavares has to be healthy.
Hyman's
coming back. And I think some of the guys, like, I'm not sure Spets is going to be around by the end. So whatever the group ultimately is not this group. So to me, I don't want to sort of go off my thought at the beginning of the year. I like this team a lot. I like the composition of skill. And so I want to stay high on them. If we're having this conversation like game 38, I think there's a big issue. I am with Blair in the sense that I do think the backup goaltending is a problem. And yes. I think they should address that sooner than later. We have just seen too many teams in the league that have a good backup goalie that allows you to, one, rest your top guy, which is incredibly important with Freddie, and two, it gets you some wins. It gets you some wins against some lesser lights, which I think you're going to need in what I think is a better conference. So I'm willing to wait, you know, I feel like 20 more games or so. Nick, I think to your point that there's still a lot of pairings that are still trying to figure it out. I mean, it took Muzzin, I would almost say, to the playoffs to sort of feel comfortable as a defensive partner. So I'm not giving up on this group. That said, 13 games in with Boston and a couple other teams still have a couple games in hand. You don't love seeing them in eighth or so. My converse would be the Lightning, which I think has as much skill, if not more skill than them, are lower than them. And I think they're going to turn it around too.
Yeah, they have games in hand too. But you're certainly right. Like, the sky isn't falling by any stretch. I do agree the backup goaltending position is so massive. As Jeff pointed out earlier, like, there's no Martin Brodeur who's going to play 65, 70 games anymore. But to that point, because of the salary cap world, and you're paying Mitch Marner, you're paying John Tavares, they have no money to pay a backup. Like, you look at Tampa, I love the value signing of Curtis McElhinney. We love that name here in Toronto. Why is he gone? Who knows? But the Boston Bruins can afford to pay Yaroslav Halak to be a backup, who's a really, really excellent netminder who will push Tugarask, right? There's all these teams and all these contenders with two viable options. And then you look at the Maple Leafs, and this isn't an indictment on Michael Hutchinson. He's not an NHL goalie, in my opinion. That remains the case.
Right.
Although I think Toronto is putting him in cases not to succeed. Like, it made too much sense a couple weeks back to play him against Minnesota, not play him in the other game. This weekend, I would have put him in against San Jose on home ice. You have the fresher hockey team. You put him on the road in the second of a back-to-back. We know the numbers are not in favor of the Maple Leafs. So I honestly, and that it's just me, I think it's Mike Babcock revolting, saying you're not going to give me a backup goalie. I'm going to throw this guy into the fire and he's going to get lit up. Like, it.
No, I'm just going to say, just hold that thought. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. I want to continue on this topic, and maybe we'll throw out some names. Like, how could the Leafs go about addressing this situation? You're right. They're up against a salary cap. They don't have a lot of wiggle room. But with Travis Dermott coming back, is there a chance that they may be able to move somebody in order to address that situation? It's a Writer's Block Monday Roundtable on Sportsnet 590 The Fan at 360.
Missed an episode of Writer's Block? Listen to every episode and subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
We discussed in the previous segment, we touched a little bit on some of the issues around the Leafs and in particular the backup goaltending situation, which, as we said, is it's not the way the NHL used to be. Now you're counting on your backup goaltender. It's actually less a backup goaltender and more number two, and there is a bit of a difference there. You want your guy who isn't your main goaltender to be able to play probably 20 games. That seems to be sort of the workable number. So far, Michael Hutchison's played four. Well, he's played in five, started four. The Leafs are 0 for his starts. And Nick Alberga, Shai Davidi joining us on the Monday roundtable. And Nick, just before the break, we were talking about, we all know where the Leafs are vis-a-vis the salary cap. We know that they're essentially tapped out in terms of the salary cap, that if you are going to bring in somebody who is going to be an upgrade over Michael Hutchinson, somebody else has, somebody else has to go as well. Both Mike Babcock and Kyle Dubas may not be in the same page all the time, but I think they're both reasonably smart people with good intentions. How do they go about making this work? Because they both have to realize that this isn't good enough right now, that Michael Hutchinson isn't good enough, and that they're frankly, you know, they're probably pissing away a couple of points because of Michael Hutchinson.
They are, although I'll say the last couple games, I really haven't pinned those losses on Michael Hutchinson. I just think from a defensive standpoint, this team is lost right now. They can't get the puck out of their zone.
granted, which we never thought would be an issue with this team,
never,
right?
Never. Like, they upgraded a bit in the offseason, but I think it's always going to be a wonder with this Maple Leafs team. But the last couple games, like, quite honestly, I haven't ripped on Michael Hutchinson too much because I don't think he's been the issue. Again, I don't know if they're setting him up for success. He always gets the back end of the back-to-back. That's the Mike Babcock world that we live in. Sad enough, I don't think it makes any sense whatsoever, but it is what it is. Like, he hasn't had an opportunity to start a game, you know, with an off day for the Maple Leafs. And that goes a long way. You have a fresh team in front of you. I'm not saying he's an incredible option in between the pipes, but again, when you're limited with cap space, I don't think it's bad right now, but could it get worse? Certainly.
There's no player they can move.
No.
To alleviate that situation.
Well,
right?
We were talking off air. Like, yeah. If you look at Cody Ceci, who are you replacing? You know, and Ceci's on a contract year. I think he makes $4.5 million this season on the contract. It's got to be money in, money out. But the problem is, if they move a guy, like, say, in their bottom six, then you've got to replace that player, right? Mm-hmm. They just don't have the depth. And again, it goes full circle. Got to pay your guys. You paid your guys, and now you're paying for it, so to speak, right? And to that point, again, we are in just game 13. It hasn't even struck November yet. I think the Leafs will find their game. I think they'll go on an epic run, and we'll be talking about how they're you know, a team prime for a Stanley Cup run here.
Shai, you made an interesting point off air as well. Our friend JP Ricciardi used to talk about how money can become an issue in a clubhouse or a dressing room. We've seen everybody get paid now for the most part in this team, right? The deals are done. Nobody, I think it's safe to say, really took a hometown discount other than perhaps John Tavares.
Right.
Could that be something that's bubbling under the surface with this group?
Well, I think the challenge, especially in a salary cap league where their players are fighting for a finite amount of dollars, is that when somebody gets theirs, somebody else isn't getting paid. And that's a dynamic that lurks in every professional clubhouse. But when there's only X amount of dollars, mm-hmm. you know, guys are looking and saying, okay, well, you know, the big boys, the big three got theirs. And now when we have issues because we can't address our need for a backup goalie because of salary cap, well, I mean, that's on, to a degree, that's on the guys who got paid. And so I think that's something that I don't think that's necessarily a factor or a reason why, but that's a dynamic that's going to be in that dressing room this year and something that could potentially turn into an issue for this team.
Yeah, but you got to become a pro too, right? Like, I like to compare it to Chicago, right? They paid Taves and Kane the exact same money because I think that is a factor nobody talks about. But from that respect, if you're Matthews, if you're Marner, John Tavares is as professional as they come. I love him becoming the captain. You got to move past that. Like, I think the ultimate goal is to win the Stanley Cup. Granted, you want to get paid. I get it. I support athletes wanting to get paid. But there comes a point in time where you have to look past that and be one cohesive unit. Why is Boston so successful, right? Every time they play, it's like it doesn't matter what line it is. They're going to bring it. Their leadership's exceptional. And that's why I think the leadership core is big. That's why I really like that Morgan Rielly takes every loss very, you know, hard. John Tavares is the same type of player. Because you look at sort of the cream and crop in this league, even St. Louis last year, guys like Ryan O'Reilly. I think I want to see these guys lead by example. I want Matthews to have that signature game, Mitch Marner to have that signature game. Morgan Rielly, I think the last couple games has really elevated his play. But until we see that, I still have my doubts about this team going forward here.
Yeah, one good sign is at least if you read the quotes out of the locker room, including after losses. Sure. What's that?
Go ahead. I just said we have 2 minutes.
Okay. You know, I've heard, I think, what you want to hear, especially from the leadership group that's there. But one thing's clear, and we were talking about this, Nick, off air, is that, you know, William Nylander and Mitch Marner have not played up to what they are compensated. That is the reality. Sure. I actually think that will happen. I'm still a believer in Nylander. But the way the team is constituted, the way that Kyle Dubas has put together the Maple Leafs, the top four guys have to be great or they can't win. They can't. I shouldn't say that. They can't get to where they ultimately want to be. They certainly can win and get to the playoffs, and so they have to be great. They are compensated as like top 30 players in the league, and I think at this point on too many nights they have not been top 30 players. I don't know if Marner's thinking about his contract. I don't know if anything is in Nylander's mind about last year, but in order for this team to ultimately get to where it wants to be, Tavares to me is always going to be steady. I don't really worry about him. And I think Matthew's skill level, he's really, you know, he's had a good year. But those two guys, to me, have to really, they have to improve their game.
I know we're pressed for time. The one guy I would look at going forward, I know they said they wouldn't move him, but to free up some money, William Nylander is a guy to look at, right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to say that.
Guys, I appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much. Nick Alberga, he is host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, along with Gord Stellick. Shai Davidi, of course, our MLB insider. Mr. Deitch, my co-host. That's it for Writer's Block today. We will be back tomorrow. Timu Solani will join us in studio tomorrow. He's got a new book. Look forward to that. Don't forget, Magic and Raptors, 7:30 on Sportsnet 590, The Fan of Sportsnet. And next, Tim and Sid. Thanks for joining us.